You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Oh, good morning. I'm Paul Ginsberg and want to welcome you to today's event, Protecting Patients from Surprise Medical Bills. The event is hosted by the Schaefer Initiative for Innovation in Health Policy, which is a collaborative effort between the USC Schaefer Center at the University of Southern California and the Brookings Institution. And for those either in person or joining us on the webcast, I invite you to join the discussion and pose questions to panelists using hashtag SurpriseBills on Twitter. I have the pleasure of introducing Leonard Schaefer, who's the reason why we're all here today. Leonard Schaefer was the founding chairman and CEO of WellPoint, now called Anthem. He is currently the Judge Robert McClay Whitney Chair and Professor at USC. In 1986, Schaefer was recruited as CEO of WellPoint's predecessor company, Blue Cross of California, when it was near bankruptcy. He managed the turnaround of Blue Cross and the IPO creating WellPoint. Under Schaefer's leadership, the value of the company grew from $11 million to over $49 billion. Before that, Mr. Schaefer served in the federal government as administrator of the Healthcare Financing Administration, now known as CMS, where he was responsible for the Medicare and Medicaid programs. In 2009, Mr. Schaefer established the Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics at USC, and he serves as the chair of the center's advisory board. He is also endowed academic chairs in health policy and economics at USC and also at Brookings, the University of California, Berkeley, the National Academy of Medicine, and Harvard Medical School. Mr. Schaefer is a graduate of Princeton University and was the Regents Lecturer at the University of California at Berkeley, a Gilbert Fellow at Princeton, and a Williams Fellow at Rand. Please join me in welcoming Leonard Schaefer to kick off today's event.
Well, somehow I don't think you all came to hear about my trouble holding a job over the years. We are here because the world of healthcare is changing and continuing to change in surprising ways. The good news is the uninsured rate hit a record low of 9.1% in 2015. And that means that it's increasingly important that Americans understand and effectively use their insurance coverage. Unfortunately, there are times when an insured individual receives care from an out-of-network provider that they did not choose, and then receives a significant surprise medical bill for those services in an amount that can be overwhelming. Nearly one-third of insured adults who have trouble paying medical bills report that the problem of medical debt is the result of an out-of-network bill. And nearly 70% of those who had trouble paying an out-of-network bill were unaware that the provider's network status at the time services were rendered. In addition, as healthcare plans move to high deductible and narrow network products, especially those that are offered on the exchanges, the number of people impacted by this issue is going to increase. Now, some states have taken action to limit the added cost of surprise medical bills. Most recently in California, lawmakers capped how much providers can charge for these surprise out-of-network costs. However, as you're going to hear from the speakers today, state action to date doesn't really address the problem for the majority of working-age adults who get coverage through self-funded employers. Today's event will look at the scope of surprise medical billing, policy reforms to address this problem, and will lay out some future action that's required. That completes my paid political announcement, and so I'm going to begin our conference by welcoming Mark Hall. He is the lead author of today's policy paper. He is the Fred D. and Elizabeth L. Turnage Professor of Law and Public Health at Wake Forest University and a newly minted non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings. He's the author, editor of 20 books, including Making Medical Spending Decisions and Healthcare Law and Ethics, heavy-duty tomes. He brings an expert voice to the discussion here today, having published numerous papers on medical billing and consumer consent. Please join me in welcoming Mark Hall to present the paper, Solving Surprise Medical Bills.
Good morning, and it's a real pleasure and honor to be here to present this paper, which is very much a collaborative effort. I was thrilled to take the lead in sort of doing the research and pulling the draft together, but the other authors had really an instrumental role in this, and it's I think the most enjoyable and productive collaborative project I've ever worked on. So I also want to thank Paul, Steve Liebermans, who's here, Lauren Adler, and Caitlin Bratt and Maggie Darling, who all have affiliations to Brookings, who helped me with this. So let's start with sort of a basic conceptual definition. You know, surprise billing, I think, could be characterized as any out-of-pocket billing, out-of-network billing, where the patient lacked what we could call a fair opportunity to seek care in that network. And what would be an absence of fair opportunity? Well, obviously, number one is if the network's simply inadequate. Maybe the patient knows that they're going out of network, but they have no choice. That's an aspect of the problem that we're not addressing. Others are working on network adequacy and what the remedies should be. The Schaefer Center might take that up in its next project, but we're really looking more at situations where there's an adequate network, but the patient still ends up out of network for reasons that are outside their control. The most obvious would be emergency care, where you simply go to the nearest hospital, and there you really have no control over the situation. I mean, you can imagine telling the ambulance to take you to whatever hospital, but that's not realistic. Oftentimes, even the ambulance might be out of network because whoever 911 sends over. And even if you go to an emergency hospital in network, you have no control over whether the providers who come to your aid, who are on call or what have you, are in network. And so that's a classic situation. It typically is the one that's first addressed by lawmakers. But beyond the emergency setting, we have other sort of physicians that are facility-based that are oftentimes non-participating, even though the facility is participating. So as you all know, doctors typically are independent from hospitals and make their own decisions about who to contract with. And so we have many situations of hospital in network, but surgeon isn't, or surgeon's in network, but assistant surgeon isn't, or surgeons are, but anesthesia isn't, or anesthesia is, but pathology isn't, and all down the line. And again, those are situations where patients have essentially no notice, and even if they did, very little at all that they could do about it. And beyond that, in outpatient settings, there are other situations to be concerned about. Routine outpatient care, referring things to labs that may or may not be in network, or sending patients to see consulting physicians and not realizing that, or diagnostic testing. So really up and down sort of the chain of treatment, it's quite possible that these arrangements could arise. And as Lynn said, it's appearing that they're arising more frequently than before. The paper has an example. This is just a prototypical. So there's various sort of extreme examples that the press would tend to focus on to show the magnitude of the problem, where the patient's left owing a bill for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, of course, sometimes the patient's left owing a bill for only a few hundred dollars. So we picked a scenario that was sort of in the middle, where you could imagine being not uncommon, a procedure. Is this showing up in any way? Can't see it. You? Well, is the pointer not working? Okay, let me see if I can do it this way. Is this arrow showing? No. Anyway, top row, let's say a procedure that's billed out at a charge matches a rate of $10,000, where the plan contracts to cover it for $4,000. Now, you might say that's a big difference, but as you know, two-and-a-half-fold difference between charge master and contracted rate is not at all unusual. So if you then look at, in-network care, followed all the way to the bottom, no problem. If you've met the deductible, which here I put up as modest, but whatever it is, if you met it, you only pay your copay, or you pay your deductible and your copay. But if you're if it's a strict HMO, classic HMO, you have no coverage whatsoever out of network, and so that $10,000 flows all the way to the bottom line. There's no contribution from the plan. And we, as we know, these HMOs or EPOs are becoming more common, particularly on the marketplace exchanges, where people are least able, because of the ones qualifying for subsidy, the least able to pay for a large bill out of network. In a more classic PPO situation, you would have some coverage, but oftentimes the plan will have its own review of whether that $10,000 is usual, customary, and reasonable, and perhaps it would decide only $6,000 is sort of the market rate for that. So the patient would still owe the provider the remaining $4,000. Plus, even with respect to the $6,000, there's oftentimes a financial penalty imposed by the plan for going out of network, which would be a co-insurance rate, say 30%, and perhaps a higher deductible. So depending on where you are with your deductible and these other assumptions, even though there's out-of-network coverage, you could well end up owing anywhere from over half to three-quarters of the full charge. And so these are very typical scenarios, as you heard, they're happening more commonly. And so in terms of the extent of the problem, what really struck me as I got into it is that there really is no disagreement among stakeholders and among the public policy community that this is a problem that needs to be addressed. I see sort of broad agreement to that basic principle from all the main stakeholders, all the specialty groups, all the provider groups, all the plans, not every single one of them, but their major representative organizations. I didn't see anyone saying, oh, this is a minor problem that the market should fix or regulators should leave alone. I also see broad bipartisan agreement in that the states that have done something on this include both blue states and red states and purple states. We heard about California, but also Texas was an early actor, Colorado, Florida, New York, some others. And so there seems to be across the political spectrum interest in dealing with this, and the paper points to various pieces of pending legislation, you know, that probably won't go anywhere in this Congress, but shows a willingness among some congressional leaders to pursue this, both from the left and the right. So rather than spending more time, let me just sort of one other example of how extensive it is. Lynn gave you some figures about how many people are affected, but this is just one example from Texas, but it's very revealing. It was simply a survey of the major carriers in Texas, Blue Cross, Humana, United, what percentage of their hospitals had zero specialists in network for key specialties. And for emergency physicians, anywhere from a fifth to over half of the hospitals of these leading networks, leading carriers, had no emergency physicians on staff. For anesthesiology, good coverage for one, but at least that most of their all their hospitals had at least one anesthesiologist. But the other two carriers, anywhere from 14 to 38% of the hospitals had zero anesthesiologists, radiologists, pathologists, neonatologists. So and this is a large state with the largest carriers, and so this is more than anecdotal, and represents the extent of the potential problem. So understanding that there's wide recognition of the problem, this paper really focuses on what are the solutions. And other papers have done a great job mapping out the extent of the problem and mapping out what is it that states are doing. This paper sort of looks at the gaps and says what else needs to be done, or which of these approaches by the states and potentially by the feds appears to hold the most promise. So first are a series of ideas that might be helpful but are incomplete. And so the first response is, well, all right, let's hold the plan responsible in some way. And we tend to do this with emergency care. So EMTALA and what have you require providers to cover emergency care, so there's no choice. So the ACA has a rule that's replicated in a number of states that patients who seek care, emergency care out of network, have to be held harmless in the sense that the plan may not charge them any more than the standard copayments. And that's a a good starting point. It goes as far as to address sort of the immediate impact on the patient and the plan's responsibility, but it doesn't address the extent to which providers can balance bills. So the ACA says that the plans must pay the providers the greater of usual rates or Medicare times 125 or contracted rates, I believe. So the plan says that the ACA says that the plan must pay the provider a certain amount, but that certain amount still might not be the full bill. So providers are still allowed to balance bill under the ACA with respect to emergency care. Another approach is to try to diminish the extent of the problem in non-emergency situations where patients might be better able to choose providers based on network status. What about giving them better notice? So better directories of who their providers are so they can look them up. That's certainly seriously needed. But where does that lead us in terms of patients who still seek care out of network? How do we know they really did that sort of voluntarily and with good information versus in a more surprise or unfair scenario where they didn't have much choice? Well, you would need something along the lines of what they happen to call in Australia informed financial consent, a nice little sabbatical junket I had. I discovered they use this idea every day. I said, well, that's an interesting little phrase. I'll build on it. So what would it mean to really give true consent to being sent out of network or using an anesthesiologist? Well, you'd have to think about what the notice says, that this is what's happening, and not just that this is what's happening, but this is how much it's going to cost you. And these elements are built into the California recent law, by the way, as well as a couple of others. You'd have to think about the timing of the notice, that it's being given sufficiently in advance, and I think California says 24 hours or something to that effect, so that patients can make other arrangements. And you'd have to think about this being done in a non-coercive way. So even with 24 hours in advance, if you know, you've already sort of made your major decisions about which surgeon and which hospital and what procedure, and you're getting down to the wire, and suddenly somebody says, oh, here's a piece of paper that says you're going to have to pay your anesthesiologist $1,500. How realistic is it that you're going to sort of call everything off and say, I got to go find myself another doctor in the hospital because this hospital doesn't have anybody in network? I think there's serious concerns there about enforcing the informed financial consent in ways that are non-coercive. And so to be most effective, the notice would also have to say, we're proposing a non-network provider, but if you don't like that, here's how you make an alternative choice and really make it truly feasible. That being said, certainly we want to preserve the right of patients to seek out their preferred doctors and not do anything that penalizes the doctors for working with patients who truly desire their services despite being adequately informed. Another idea that's in discussion that we think is useful but it only goes so far is to think to what extent hospitals have some leverage over their hospital-based specialists. So if the hospital is in network, to most people's logic, shouldn't that mean that the hospital-based specialists are, but as we know, they're independent. But hospitals could exert a certain amount of influence through their contracting, so if they have a selective contract for emergency care or radiology or what have you, couldn't that contract say, well, to be part of this selective contract, you have to at least belong to our major networks, maybe not every single one. Or even further thought, credentialing to be part of the medical staff. We want to present ourselves as a single integrated, ACO type, whatever, so we can contract with plans and providers. We can't do that unless we're all sort of on board here. And so if you want to be part of the institution, we need to all be willing to contract together. So there's a lot of attraction to that, but there's also a lot of realistic limitations. In many places, hospitals lack the leverage to do this or to get this leverage, because there's enough competition. Physicians can go elsewhere. Physicians have consolidated and simply are going to push back. Or if they're going to get that leverage, they'll have to pay for it. And so we read about how hospitals already have to pay specialists to do on-call coverage because many of those patients are uninsured, and that can get to be expensive. So if we did that more across the board, is an expense that could get built into the hospital rates that get passed on to the consumer. So it doesn't constitute a full solution, although it's something well worth thinking more about. But the point so far is that there isn't a magic bullet solution, that we can't simply say health plan fix it, provider may not balance bill, just simply get the patient better informed. It's a much more complex problem that requires a multifaceted response. So in my remaining time, which I don't see a clock, but somebody will wave at me if I'm going on too long, we want to think more comprehensively. So how to fix the problem in as sort of as comprehensive way as possible. So I'll start with some few basic principles and get on to our sort of bullet point suggestions. The first is, the main principle is, the first rule of surprise billing is, hold the patient harmless. I mean, the judgment is, it's not fair to the patient, and whatever disagreement there is ought to be worked out between the plan and the provider. Let the patient off the hook. So to some extent, that does mean ban balance billing once you've decided what the payment rules are between the plan and the provider. So that's a simple, clear kind of edict that we shouldn't lose sight of in crafting these things. The next thing is, once we hold the patient harmless, there is a genuine dispute between the plan and the provider, and we have to figure out what is the fair and efficient way to resolve that disagreement over what should be paid between two, you know, by definition, non-contracting parties. They could go to court and work it out, but that approach is expensive and clumsy, time-consuming, and courts really lack guidance on what are the governing principles here. These contract terms, there aren't a contract, but the sort of the governing concepts that might come out of regulation, is the network adequate? Is there an obligation to pay reasonable rates? Are too mushy and squishy for courts to really be enthusiastic about getting in and resolving all this. They see it as messing with, you know, an area that ought to be regulated, or we ought to leave the parties alone or something. So it's not as if the courts shouldn't be resorted to, but they are hardly sort of the first and best process on an ongoing basis. The other principle is to, whatever we come up with, think about the potential distortion of market mechanisms. So a rule that says, you know, put the onus on the health plan would mean providers have much less incentive to negotiate because they're going to get paid anyway, particularly if they're in a specialty that for whom most of their business or much of their business comes can come from out of network, such as emergency care. But if you say, let's cap what we pay the providers at, you know, something close to Medicare, then what incentive do the providers have to negotiate further to join the network? So they'll just if this is all I'm going to get, I'll take my, you know, Medicare times, you know, whatever, 25%, and just sit out of network. And so you want a process that sort of sets boundaries on either side, but still leaves room and incentive for negotiation. And that's a tricky balance to call for, but it's something to be aware of. Finally, the solution needs to be comprehensive in the following ways that existing law fails to do. First, need to cover all plan types. So a number of states have laws that govern HMOs, because if there's no out-of-network coverage, that's the problem's no severe. But we need EPOs, which are indemnity-regulated versions of HMOs, and we also need PPOs covered, because as networks get narrower and penalties for going out-of-network get stronger, the problems are significant there. Most importantly, we need to remember that only half the market in terms of private insurance is state regulated. The other half is not state regulated because it's ERISA preempted self-funded plans. And so it seems silly to construct a thoughtful, comprehensive solution that leaves out half the market. And we have no reason to believe that the incidence of this is any different in large groups than small groups, except possibly differences in the size of the network could mean it's a little less significant. But certainly all the fundamental elements are just the same. And in fact, in self-funded plans, it's possible that the financial consequence could be more severe, because self-funded plans have more freedom to limit what they pay out of network, and the reports that they aren't paying UCR, they're paying just a contracted rate, Medicare plus 60% or some other number, which could leave patients exposed to even more balanced billing. So obviously to get to self-funded plans, we need a federal solution, and also all the major treatment areas, not just emergency, but all facility-based, and some thought about whether you go beyond facilities to outpatient. So here are the specifics, and I believe my final, two slides. Federal action's needed, or you're not going to get a comprehensive solution. Starting point is, since the feds already regulate what is an emergency care, EMTALA says you have to treat, prudent layperson rule says this has to be considered an emergency if it feels like one. And for these situations, the plan has to pay the highest of three rates to the provider. So since you go that far, it's only one final, modest step to go ahead and ban balanced billing. So it seems logical that that would be built into federal action. And it would cover all plan types. Then with respect to non-emergency care, states need authority to regulate, or the self-insured plans, which would require a congressional amendment, or you need a federal fallback for states that don't regulate, following kind of a HIPAA model that first started that idea, a federal standard that states are welcome to emulate, but or some combination of federal and state regulation. And this gets more complex, but states are authorized to regulate provider payment rates under ERISA. The feds are currently authorized to regulate dispute resolution mechanisms by plans. So there might be a creative way of combining the federal authority over dispute resolution with the state authority over provider rates and create some kind of ERISA hybrid thing that, would need some more thought. But these creative minds can work this out. Or, just a piece of legislation that says, boom, here's what we're doing. But tricky terrain, but it has to be worked through if you want a comprehensive solution, something other than half the population. Then what does the solution entail? Dispute resolution. We hear a lot about this in terms of New York and Florida and California. Some states use independent review, the same type of process they use to resolve medical necessity disputes. That would be perfectly fine. Other states, and New York has been the leader in this, come up with a really expedited, streamlined resolution process known as baseball style or best offer, meaning the parties come to the table with their best and final offer. Final offer is actually the phrase, best or final. Final should be in there. And then the arbitrator can only pick one or the other of those numbers, can't split the baby. And that's done based on sort of, limited presentation. So it's an incentive to settle so that you don't, because it's all or nothing kind of stakes. And it can be set up in a way that's done expeditiously. So there's interesting sort of experimentation going on. This is different than other concepts such as mediation, which is simply trying to achieve settlement, does not produce binding results, or voluntary arbitration, which is binding, but parties don't have to engage into it unless they want to. So you have to be careful in terms of dispute resolution. Is it mandatory? Is it binding? And is it an efficient form of it? So with that said, then we come back to the sort of the, 800-pound gorilla. What do we do with rates? And we simply can't avoid some attempt to benchmark rates, because these dispute resolution mechanisms have to have some standard that governs what is the payment rate. And so right now we just have, UCR, usual, customary, and reasonable. And that could give better definition, but there are other ideas out there that are worth considering. So first of all, to benchmark rates doesn't mean you have to set rates. You could benchmark rates in ways that are presumptive, that say, in the absence of party dispute or in the absence of party agreement, these are presumptively the most that the provider can get paid, or the least that the plan has to pay. So you can have a sort of a floor and a ceiling that set sort of default payment rates that then can be further challenged if one of the parties feels that the ceiling's too high or the floor is too low or what have you. So as opposed to saying this is the rate. So both of those can be done, and we see examples in different states. That benchmarking can be done as a percentage or percentile, which are two different concepts, statisticians, of one of three things. You can work off of Medicare, which I understand is controversial, but Some people say 200% of Medicare. So just because it's Medicare doesn't mean it needs to be 25% of Medicare, although, you know. You could take this idea of amounts generally billed that's been built into the tax code as the reference point for charging low-income patients by tax-exempt hospitals. So it's a formula for calculating what's the typical amount that the health plan pays and under its commercially negotiated managed care contracts. And you could take that and then add a percentage to that. So you could say 20 or 25% over sort of their standard contracted rate, however phrased. But the concept and the phrasing is already in the IRS law without the add-on mount, but you could add on the mount for others. Or you could designate a certain sort of commonly accepted database, and we often hear about Fair Health, and this is referenced in New York law and Connecticut law as the place where you go to find what is UCR, and say, well, UNC, usual and customary, is in their database. Reasonable is the, say, 85th percentile or the 75th percentile or whatever percentile the regulators agree to. So with all that said, I ended up with my Goldilocks analogy, which I used in the paper, which is this, again, is not a silver bullet magic solution. You got approaches that seem too lenient, approaches that seem too aggressive, but in the middle, I think there is this sort of just right mix of solutions. It's a bit of a porridge in the sense that it's not, you know, a single ingredient thing. It requires a number of elements working together. But we hope through this paper and this analysis to sort of bracket it out what we think are sort of the most viable ideas moving forward. We hope that as we engage the stakeholder panel and the public policy panel, that we can get more thoughtful reaction to this. And so with that, I'll sort of conclude my remarks. I'll take sort of more discussion during the stakeholder process. But thank you for your attention, and let me next call up our next moderator. Dana Goldman is a distinguished economist at USC, where he directs the Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics. And let me also call forward the next panel, the stakeholder panel, if you all will presumably take seats here. Is that right, Dana, on the stage? Okay, and get mic'd up. All right, well, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much, and welcome, everyone. I think Mark set the stage quite nicely, and the key theme, of course, as always, is that healthcare is very complicated. Now we're going to get a chance to hear from the stakeholders. I want to introduce our panelists. We have Betsy Imholtz. She's Director of Special Projects from Consumers Union. Tom Prisilak, who is the president and CEO of Cedars-Sinai Health System in Los Angeles. Colin Drozdowski, who's a vice president and for National Provider Solutions at Anthem. And Jeffrey Bajenhoff,
I'm used to it.
Yeah. You're very understanding on that. You coached me before, too. He's the president-elect of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. And so I think we're going to let each of them provide a five-minute to seven-minute background on this topic, because we do want to make sure all the positions are represented. But I think, you know, to set the stage, the Partnership for Fighting Chronic Disease published a survey recently, and 7 out of 10 people are reporting one or more coverage issues, with insurance not covering as much as they expected, and with an unexpected medical bill being the primary problem in 58% of the cases. And so this is widely prevalent in a way people may not understand. On the other hand, as I think Leonard Schaefer pointed out, the best tools we have right now for controlling healthcare costs are copays, deductibles, and also the ability to select narrow networks and providers that provide efficient care. And so the challenges for us as we think about where healthcare is going are enormous, and we need to keep those in mind. So let me turn it over to Betsy first.
You want us to stay seated?
Yes.
Okay. Good morning. He's just shrunk our time from 7 to 5 minutes. So I'm going to race through what I can here.
You can have your full seven.
I'll take the full seven. Okay. Well, I think it's fitting and appreciate that the consumer perspective is jumping this off because, of course, it's consumers who are the ones that get stuck with these surprise, unexpected bills. Consumers Union has a national campaign to stop surprise out-of-network bills. And our work started with some egregious cases that we came to our attention in New York. Including one of a woman named Claudia Naffo, and I have to just put the human face on this for a minute to start out. She's a concert pianist in New York, and when she needed cervical spine surgery in 2012, she did her due diligence. She's a savvy consumer, like a Consumer Reports reader. She went to make sure that the surgeon was in-network, the recommended surgeon, by checking with the hospital website and several different sources, and they all confirmed that this was an in-network surgeon. Yet a month after the surgery, she found that she got a $100,000 bill, and it is one of those alarmingly huge bills for the total amount of services. The insurer sent her a check for $67,000, which is a pretty good chunk. She endorsed it over to the doctor, but only then learned that the doctor for several years had not been in the network. So she was going to be liable for $33,000. It's a saga that led to some heavy-handed collection tactics, to her even considering divorce as a strategy to protect her family assets, and incredible stress for a woman recovering from a major surgery. So luckily, her story has a happy ending, because with her perseverance and with the intervention of the New York State Department of Financial Services, the bill was waived. So her story ended well, but not so for the many thousands of people who've contacted Consumers Union over the past couple years from across the country with these stories. Our National Research Center did a representative survey, nationally representative survey in 2015, and found that 1 in 4 people over the prior 2 years had had a bill from a doctor that they didn't know and didn't expect to get a bill from. Of those who had been hospitalized in the prior 2 years, 1 in 4 had a bill that was charged at out-of-network rates when they expected it to be in-network. And we know from secret shopper work we've done in California that, as other speakers have mentioned, for some specialties, such as anesthesiology, in-network hospitals may have no providers at all in-network. As to whether the problem is growing, just to keep the discussion lively, I have to offer a counter view, because I'm not necessarily convinced that the problem is growing. Several reasons why the issue has gained prominence are, first of all, many more people are covered with individual market coverage for the first time. So the sheer number of people covered is more, and therefore any problems in the market are going to be compounded. Secondly, some products are rising in prevalence. Someone mentioned EPOs and that kind of product that doesn't cover out-of-network cost at all. Those are growing, we see at least in California, in prevalence. And third, there is this issue of some specialist consolidation going on, so that we have found, for example, anesthesiologists coming together in groups and then being unable to negotiate a contract with the carrier and therefore not joining as in-network. Many of the stories we've gotten are older stories, stories from prior to the Affordable Care Act. And I know in California, for many years, we've been working on this issue. Since 2009, there was a case, involving emergency coverage. So I'm not totally convinced it's a growing problem. It's certainly not a new one. But I do agree with the paper that the market incentives are not there for the providers and carriers to correct it themselves. And so we do need policy solutions. I was asked to talk about what we think are good policies from the consumer perspective. And obviously, it's to get the consumer out of the middle of these contract and reimbursement disputes between carriers and providers. But the consumer interest also is, in the longer term, to contain premiums and health system costs. So here are three elements I would give of a good policy solution. And I'm speaking on the state level because that's primarily where we've worked and we've had a lot of success. First, require that consumers pay no more than out-of-network, no more than in-network costs for those out-of-network services where they didn't choose to go out-of-network, but it was sort of foisted upon them. And count that cost sharing that they do pay toward their deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums. Second, explicitly ban balance billing. And it's probably also a good idea to prohibit providers from even sending a bill at all for the in-network cost sharing until they've gotten word from the insurance company about what the correct amount is. Because there will still have to be some kind of billing, but we want it to be the correct amount. And third, base the default reimbursement, or the presumptive reimbursement, as Professor Hall called it, to out-of-network providers on the average contracted rate or Medicare plus a percent. In California, we ended up with Medicare plus 125%, the greater of that or the average contracted rate, and create an independent dispute resolution process for providers and plans to allow for speedy, inexpensive resolution. And this is basically what the new California bill enacted this year does provide. As an adjunct issue, not a substitute, but an adjunct issue, I would say that correcting the provider directories is also essential. It's right that it won't take care of this surprise billing problem, but it may in some cases help people avoid going out of network. And it may also give regulators a cross-check mechanism about network adequacy, which is really hard to track. While the comprehensive solution is ideal, I totally agree with Professor Hall on that, we know that legislation is the art of the possible. And so in many states, they've started out with emergency room protection or HMO protection. And we take what we can get to some extent. We aim for the moon, but we'll accept something a little less if it takes away some of the pain that consumers are really experiencing. And of course, I've mentioned the states, but we would love a federal solution, a comprehensive federal solution that takes care of everything. All the self-insured folks, as well as the commercial market, would be terrific. So Congress does need to act, I agree. A leader in this has been Congressman Lloyd Doggett, who has a bill he's introduced that would take care of the balance billing in emergency situations, but certainly more is needed. The paper notes that Congress could simply give states the authority to fix the ERISA plans in their state, and that's an interesting alternative that seems like something simple that Congress could do that would at least empower the states to move. As to bad policy ideas, there are a lot of them. Professor Hall listed a number of them, and I'll just tick off a few things. Requiring consumers to go to mediation regarding their bills is a bad idea. Our survey last year found that people just don't complain. 90% of people in our nationally representative survey didn't even know what state agency was charged with handling insurance complaints. So when consumers have to initiate the process, it's not a good idea. Instead, the law explicitly needs to set the amount as the in-network cost in these defined circumstances and have that kind of clarity and then prohibit balance billing. In Texas, they've tried this. They do have a statute that requires consumer mediation and even sets dollar thresholds, and there are problems with it. So consumer advocates there are trying to work that out and amend that. Another inadequate solution is the notice point that Professor Hall mentioned, assuming that notice alone is enough. People just don't have the opportunity in many of these situations to shop around, and that's certainly not going to be sufficient. And in a foundational sense, I'd say that basing out-of-network provider reimbursement on billed charges may simply perpetuate inflated costs and unreasonable system costs, which in the end drives up premiums for all consumers. There's just really no basis for believing that all those billed charges are reasonable charges. In fact, studies have shown, as you all know, I'm sure, that billed charges are many times the Medicare rate. And I would just add that there's a lot of griping about the Medicare rate, but Medicare rates are set by a committee, the RUC committee, and don't ask me what the acronym is, I always forget. But it's a group of doctors and dominated by specialists, which examines what the appropriate intensity of the service is and what the appropriate rate is. And there's been complaints about that being dominated by specialists, the very specialists who are now saying the Medicare rate is too inadequate. So anyway, in conclusion, I would say that it is not a red or blue issue. Every legislator on the state and federal level and every staffer we've talked with knows someone who's had this problem of the surprise out-of-network bill. So the issue really has traction. And in 2016, nearly two dozen states took a step of some kind to try to address the issue and protect consumers. Not all succeeded, but many were bipartisan. And we're hoping that in 2017, the states and Congress will come back and really try to tackle the issue, because it's a major pain point for consumers.
Thank you very much. Tom?
Great. Thanks. Good morning, everyone. Before I begin my remark, a quick disclaimer. My comments from the provider perspective hopefully represent many and maybe even most provider perspective, but I want to be clear that it doesn't represent all provider perspectives, so offer that in the beginning. Second, quickly, the context in terms of where I'm coming from at Cedars-Sinai, and that is that we have about 2,000 physicians who are associated with Cedars-Sinai. About two-thirds of them are in some sort of aligned economic relationship with the institution, but a third of them are also private practitioners. I bring this up because as an organization, and this is not uncommon in other organizations, this is an issue that we deal with both as a provider of physician services, but also as a hospital in which private practice physicians are coming to treat their patients every day. In terms of the issue, I think the root of the issue really is the tension that we continue to struggle with in healthcare. This is, it's not unique to the question of out-of-network coverage between market forces and, on the one hand, and also having a regulatory framework that is adequate to address both broad public interest issues as well as individual patient issues. And in that regard, again, this is not a kind of a unique item. We really don't have a federal, or we don't have any sort of overarching mechanism, either at the state or federal level, to deal with these kind of issues holistically. And so, once again, on this issue, we find ourselves in a situation where there's enough social interest in a matter of sufficient economic consequence for people that you get political action, in this case, on a specific item. The rest of my comments will be oriented towards AB 72, both because I think they do represent some of the principles that were covered in the article and the prior speaker, but also because that's my own reality and our reality in California. It's one I can speak to the best. First, I want to start by saying I believe, and I think many providers believe, that we're very glad that the patient is being taken out of the middle of this. I think, unfortunately, as we struggle in the American healthcare system around some of the issues I described earlier, we oftentimes fail to think about how do we keep the patient out of the middle of this. And I think the fact that's occurred is a good thing. In California, it comes on the heels of prior actions. This matter has been dealt with as it relates to hospital services out of network and emergency department services out of network, with prior legislation in California on both of those. The law starts on July of next year, and as plans are issued, amended, or created, and which is important language I'll come back to in a moment with regard to the implications, as the plans are issued or amended, there is a provision that essentially prevents patients from having an out-of-pocket cost for out-of-network services any more than they would have had as in-network. So that's the definitive solution in terms of the individual patients out of pocket. There is a mechanism for at least 24-hour consent by the patient if they are to have an out-of-pocket payment more than that. So it does provide for that mechanism that was mentioned. In terms of the payment rate, the payment rates will be determined by the average in a particular region. The region, it's how the region is going to be defined, is yet to be, as with many of the regulations, is yet to be answered, or 125% of Medicare, whichever is greater. There is a provision for an annual increase according to medical CPI, and there is a provision for independent dispute resolution. If there is an issue with regard to the rates. There's a network adequacy requirement, so the issue of providing an incentive for the health plans to have an adequate in-network network in the area is an issue that the law addresses. It uses a 15-mile or 30-minute rule to determine network adequacy, which is probably okay in some parts of California, but in Los Angeles, where it can take an hour to go 4 miles, I'm not sure exactly how that definition works. The law does not apply to emergency circumstances. As I said earlier, that's been covered by prior legislation and has been observed by the prior speaker. It doesn't apply to ERISA. So, you know, from my perspective, I've been in California for 38 years. I would just observe that I think the root cause of this has been a 30-year tug of war that has existed between physicians and health plans over what is fair and reasonable compensation. That's not a critical statement. That's the reality of how markets work. But it is, I think, what has led to this. And we have a solution now. We have a political solution that has pros and cons associated with it, like all political solutions do. And as I said earlier, the most important thing is the patient's out of the middle. Whether the balance between the market power balance between health plans and physicians has been reached as a result of the legislation, I think it's too early to tell by definition. A couple of things about the law that I would just mention as possible concerns and to keep an eye on going forward. First, by definition, the law does create, in essence, a rate cap, and there are issues, all of the issues associated with rate caps are potentially at risk. There is given the way that the rate system is set up, there is an incentive for health plans to lower the payment rates to the higher paid physicians or physician groups, whether those are deserved or not. But there is that incentive, because by lowering the higher limit, you will lower the average payment rate, which is what would be used. I think for many community hospitals, they will find themselves being approached again by various specialists who will be looking to the hospital to provide some payment to them in order for them to be available for services that patients in those hospitals may need. As physicians seek what they think is an adequate income level, they will seek that income from whatever sources might be available. There is increased administrative complexity associated with this. Again, not a reason not to do this, but I also think we should be honest with ourselves and acknowledge that, because that does come with a cost. In California, the complexity is maybe more complex because we have two regulators. We don't just have one regulator for health insurance. We have two. There are conflicting rules of how an emergency case is defined between those two regulators as of right now. I mentioned earlier the rolling implementation. So this will take effect as plans are issued, as new plans are issued. And so for those people administering physician billing, over some period of time, they will be dealing with, is this an AB 72 patient or not? Many of the implementing regs have not yet been written, including exactly how the independent dispute resolution process will work. The law calls for a certain way for the rates to be determined between now and 2019, and then in 2019, there's going to be an Uber solution to this, and so that is unknown exactly how it's going to play out. And then the ERISA issue. So I think that there are legitimate issues to keep our eye on in order to make this successful going forward. My last comment is, I do think that this is an example where the issue of creating healthcare services organizations, more economically aligned, integrated organizations that are inclusive of hospitals, physicians, and perhaps others, is a good thing. I'm sure there's probably a meeting here tomorrow about why that's not a good thing. I personally believe it's a good thing for other reasons, but on this matter, it is a good thing, because it does allow institutions in the course of their relationship with physicians and that organization to be able to put in place the kind of mechanisms which we've done at Cedars-Sinai, which is physicians who are aligned with us in that way. Either agree to accept out of in-network payments, or some mechanism is established where this issue is taken away from an individual patient situation. There are implementation issues associated with that, and we wrestle with that every day, but it does create an environment. People have raised the question, why can't, and the prior speaker mentioned, why can't this be done through the hospital-physician relationship, typical hospital relationship? And the reality is the nature of the hospital-medical staff relationship is just not designed, frankly, to deal with these kind of issues. And that's why it hasn't been dealt with until now.
So. Thank you. Great. Colin?
Well, good morning. I'm Colin Drostowski, and I'm pleased to be here today, so thank you for having me. I'm with Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and we'll bring to you the perspective from the payer's side. In my professional career for the last 25 years, in some way, shape, or form, my team and I have been provider-facing. So this problem is very real to us on a day-to-day basis, and I'll try to give you some practical observations that I hope will shape and inform our conversation. From the perspective of the health plan, I think it's safe to say that we can sort of generically and loosely classify physicians into two categories. Those who want to contract and work with payers, and frankly, those that do not. Those who want to contract and work with payers represent the overwhelming majority of physicians, and there is that healthy tug of war that Tom referenced, and that exists and has existed for decades. Mm-hmm. That I don't think is going to change. The much smaller category are those physicians who really are seeking to game the system in some way, shape, or form. And candidly, I think they're seeking to game the system at the expense of the patient, at the expense of the consumer, at the expense of the employer, at the expense of the healthcare system, and at the expense of the health plan. So that's sort of the category in many ways that I think we're talking about today, where you bring in this idea of the surprise bill or the balance bill. From the viewpoint or the perspective of the consumer or the patient, I would say that they also classify non-participating, non-contracted physicians into two categories. Those that are non-contracting, that they have the opportunity and the awareness of that they are non-contracting, and therefore in advance of care, they can make a reasonable decision, a reasonable determination of what is best for them. Do they want to continue to receive these services from a non-participating provider, or do they not? And then the other category, which again is what we're here to talk about today, those instances where they really don't have a choice in that physician, or the choice is made available to them so close to the event that it's not practical for them to sort of cause a pivot or a change in care. The problem of surprise bills or balance bills is not new. As I said, it's been ongoing for as long as I've been in this industry. What I would suggest is that there are two things that maybe are new or different. One is the degree of the balance bill. What we are experiencing at Anthem on behalf of our consumers is that the amount of bill, the amount that the consumer, the patient, is now being subjected to is growing and growing exponentially. It's not uncommon to see a bill for $100,000 on a service that at a contracted rate might be $5,000. And we have more egregious examples than that. And the other piece is the breadth. Historically, this problem generally has been constrained to or confined to what are known as hospital-based physicians. Think radiologists, anesthesiologists, pathologists, emergency room physicians, neonatologists. That's generally the cluster of physicians where this surprise bill existed. The breadth that I'm referencing is more in this creative solution that is really, really detrimental to the consumer. And the best example I can give you is a physician that's a surgeon will either employ or work with an assistant surgeon. And this is a designed scheme, if you will. That physician, the primary surgeon, will contract with the health plan or will contract with all health plans at their standard rates, but he or she will then bring in this non-participating assistant surgeon into the OR, and in some cases, or many cases, where that assistant surgeon isn't even needed, and then the patient finds out after the surgery, because they were frankly unconscious at the time, that an assistant surgeon was brought in, and now they find this bill for whatever the amount may be. That breadth is somewhat new to the equation, and I think it introduces a unique and distinct dynamic to this problem. I know that time is tight, so I'll abbreviate my comments. There are no simple solutions, right? You've heard that from every single presenter. It is a complex problem. I would agree with all of my predecessor presenters that there is a shared desire to address the problem. There is no one single solution that I think is most fitting. I agree that the professor has brought forth some very thoughtful solutions, but those in among themselves are not easy. What I'm going to leave you with are just simply five observations that maybe will provoke some thought and discussion and questions as we move forward. But it's really to describe how we as constituents in this process either introduce intended or in some cases unintended consequences that are contributing to or exacerbating this problem of surprise bills. And so I'll start with the one that I began with. And these are, by the way, not in any particular order, so don't think that the first is most important. I think they're sort of all of equal concern. But the first here is physicians, right? I mentioned at the very beginning that there is a subset of providers that are really seeking to exploit the system. And there are multiple ways that they might do that. They might do that through federal EMTALA laws or emergency laws. They might do that through local or state laws that require certain payments for non-participating providers. They might do that through health plan policies around how they do or do not pay for non-participating services. So that's option one, or observation one. Observation two, regulators. And I want to be clear, I believe that a regulatory solution is an important part of this problem. But with the best of intentions, some of our existing regulatory solutions could actually serve as contributors or exacerbators to this problem. And that is if they require payment of billed charges in all circumstances or even in emergency circumstances without a reasonable cap or a reasonable way to set what those rates should be. The one that I don't think has really been addressed in this room, and it's not one that's immediately self-evident, although I think the professor addressed this idea of self-funded employers. And if you're not familiar with that term, that means that about 50% or more of the healthcare insurance that exists today are rendered by employers who are responsible for that payment, not health plans. The risk of the medical expense resides with those employers. And because those employers, particularly the large jumbo accounts or the national accounts, in some cases have the best interest of their employees, the best interest of their dependents at heart, they're saying we need to pull them out of the equation. And that's a good thing. Let me be very clear, that's a good thing. But in doing so, what they're saying to the health plans is we want you to pay billed charges. And so what does that do? It creates this unintended incentive for those providers who are non-participating to say, wow, if one out of every five or one out of every 10 times I see somebody, I get paid billed charges. They may not know exactly why they're getting paid those billed charges, but it's like winning the lottery. And not only is it like winning the lottery, they get to set the amount they win. And if they don't like the amount they're winning or the frequency by which they're winning, they simply increase their charges. So there are unintended consequences there. Health plans, right? Certainly, I think you have to look at the health plan and say, in our efforts to make healthcare affordable, in our efforts to narrow networks and to optimize care, one could say, have we gone too far? Are we setting rates that are not sustainable, that are too aggressive? It's the tug of war that was described. And lastly, the hospital component to this. It is clearly prudent for hospitals to issue contracts for certain hospital-based services, right? It's efficient to do so, and they typically will bid those in some process and typically award a single contract to an anesthesia group. So that group will supply all anesthesia services at a hospital, or that group might supply all ER services or all radiology services. And it makes good sense to do so. But in doing that, you then create sort of a monopoly provider who can say, well, I'm the only access point you have for anesthesia at this hospital, or I'm the only access point you have for pathology. And that problem is not new, but what is also occurring, and one of the speakers alluded to this, is that the hospital-based groups are also coming together. So even if you were made aware that at Hospital A, the emergency room group was non-contracted, you think, well, you know, send me to Hospital B, it's now possible that Hospital B is also staffed by that same emergency room group or that same pathology group. And so the consumer finds themselves stuck in the middle in terms of you have statewide or regional monopolies of hospital-based providers that are complicating that problem. So I will stop there because I know our time is tight. So thank you.
Well, we'd love to hear from the provider after that. So, Jeff.
Thank you. So I'm the physician on the panel and the provider. This is going to be interesting. I'm heartened to see that we do agree on several things, but the provider's viewpoint is what has been missing from a lot of dialogues in this regard. And even in the creation of the white paper, I don't think I saw a provider as part of the team. So we're going to shed a slightly different light on it, and we look forward to the questions and answers afterwards. So I am the incoming president of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. We're about a 52,000-member healthcare association, and for those of you not familiar with physician anesthesiologists, we're the highly trained medical experts who evaluate, monitor, and deliver vital care to patients before, during, and after surgery. So as a physician, my training is in medicine, not medical insurance. Unfortunately, in this new era of increasingly confusing insurance products, we're caught in the middle with our patients who are forced to purchase complex insurance policies. Regardless, these are our patients, and helping them in any way that we can is part of our DNA. So this is a multifactorial, multifaceted problem that really is not understood by many at all. Proposed solutions just addressing symptoms instead of the root cause are flawed approaches, similar to just treating symptoms of disease instead of focusing on patient wellness and prevention of disease. We believe balanced bills are symptoms of the issue. The cause is gaps in insurance coverage. We appreciate that the media has brought this issue to the public's attention, and we look forward to working with other stakeholders here and believe that the most successful solutions can only be formulated by working all together as a team. Our primary goal is ensuring access for patients to care inclusive of all services that they or their family may need. This is not the situation for many unsuspecting patients right now. What we have learned is that the problem is not really the surprise bills as much as the problem is surprises in what insurance covers and doesn't cover. Specifically, insurance companies are failing to create adequate and readily accessible networks. There are multitudes of reports of insurance companies narrowing networks as a strategy to limit their cost and to shift those costs to patients and other stakeholders. By tiering and progressively narrowing the networks that they create, insurance companies are only exacerbating the problem that originated from changes in health insurance that were introduced by them in the first place. Unfortunately, patients learn the hard way about gaps in insurance coverage, not when they purchase their insurance, but when they hope to be covered by it. All is good when patients are healthy and not needing reliable insurance coverage. Monthly premiums are affordable and network adequacy isn't even on their radar. But then a need arises for healthcare services, possibly in an urgent or emergent scenario. Then the surprises pop up. Unaffordable copays, high deductibles, and payment denials front-loaded in amounts that can be devastating. All as a result of the deliberate cost shifting. As if narrow networks were not complicated enough, tiering makes it even worse. Providers can be in network with a carrier in one tier, say for example the gold tier, and out of network with the same carrier in another tier, for instance the bronze tier. So when transparency about insurance coverage is proposed as a solution, it's incredibly important to understand that only the insurance companies know day-to-day who is in and who is out of networks that they construct. We don't even know at times. maintaining accessible networks with adequate numbers of all providers and all services, as well as a mechanism for fair out-of-network payment, are the keys to solving the problem. Patients work hard for their insurance policies. With the complex design of all these products, it's incredibly difficult to discern what policies truly provide consumers. Physician organizations across the country are now working together to promote the rights of patients to have well-defined, effectively communicated, easily understood, and fair minimum standard benefits. And again, legislation that would solve these issues must include preventative strategies attacking the cause of the problem and not just the symptoms. My family fell victim to this problem too. Now listen carefully, because our story epitomizes what has happened to insurance coverage in this country. Not only am I deeply involved in insurance coverage in this country, but my wife, current president of the Texas Society of Anesthesiologists, has been working for over a decade advocating for patients struggling with insurance that fails them in times of need. We learned firsthand of the gaps, complexities, surprises, and frustrations with our family's insurance with her mammogram. She needed a biopsy. After communicating with her hospital and our health insurance representatives, we were very disappointed to learn the procedure had to be performed at a competing hospital, the only one in network, if we wanted to avoid thousands of dollars of cost to our family. We spent considerable time and effort, and I mean considerable, asking detailed questions on both the payer and the provider side of this equation. We did our homework. We were assured that this was a woman's preventative health service, which therefore was said to be well covered, and we were really excited when both sides said all we would have to pay is $150. Thought great. After her procedure, we received both good and bad news. Benign, thank God. But bad news followed 6 months later when we received a bill for $1,800. In spite of arguably being the experts on this subject and doing all of our homework, we still received an unexpected big bill. After all of our work to be aware, responsible, and informed patients to safeguard against some surprise, we learned firsthand of the gaps in our coverage. Once again, we got a bill 12 times what we were told to expect. Regarding the white paper, I applaud the professor and his team. There are a number of components and recommendations that we agree with. I'd like to note, however, the white paper is based on the assumption that patients are billed by out-of-network providers, even though the patients did all they could to remain in-network. With my personal experience I just shared, I'm quite sympathetic to that scenario. However, it should be strongly understood that the vast majority of physicians want to be in-network, as my friend said. With networks narrowing and tiering, the frequency of surprise bills is increasing. The truth is that there are very few physician outliers sending exorbitant bills. That has been shown. But the insurance lobby is claiming to the contrary and inaccurately yet persuasively portraying few examples out there as the rule rather than the exception. In a free market capitalistic economy, there will always be a few charging higher rates for whatever they sell. And in medicine, the emphasis should be on a few. A small minority of physicians send these huge bills. The vast majority of physicians report they want to be and try to be in network and are met with, we don't need any more physicians. We're full. We want the patient volume that comes with being in network. We want the stability that comes from being in network. Our practice administrators really want us to be in network so they know what to bill and what they can expect that we will be paid. So their narrative is not true. It's not that we won't come to the table to negotiate, which I've seen printed in the press in multiple places. We aren't being allowed at the insurance company-controlled tables in many instances. To summarize, physicians want patients to have ready access to physician networks capable of providing the care and services that they need. The best solutions will maintain incentives for insurance companies to appropriately negotiate in good faith with physicians for adequate, complete, and comprehensive networks. We worked on solutions to this, and we propose a big solution where BIG, an acronym, stands for Ban Big Insurance Gaps, because they are the cause of balanced billing and the surprises that come with them. We've also learned through our studies that patients want and expect physicians to help them with this, and we see that physician perspectives are missed by many, including many proposing solutions. So We are, too, looking for just the right porridge. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to ask all of you a few questions. But, Colin, you spoke about providers trying to exploit the system. Jeff has set up an alternative view here, which is, and we saw some data from Mark suggesting that the networks in Texas are inadequate. And so the result of this is that people don't have access to some providers that they obviously need. How do you respond to that?
I would first respond by saying I think that's a situational issue. But in general, if you look at what provider types, what specialties tend to be at the core of these surprise bills, I would dare say that certainly Anthem and most insurance companies do all that they can to have them in all of their networks. I agree that narrowing, I think you made reference to it, is certainly part of what we're looking to do. But when we as health plans think of narrowing networks, it does not immediately mean, boy, we want to narrow radiology, we want to narrow emergency room, we want to narrow pathology. That is not where we're going. It's in the broader areas where we see greater variation in care, we see greater variation in cost, where there's increased competition among those particular specialties. But while I appreciate his comments, the data would say that where the balance bills are coming from are in those specialties that we're certainly not looking to narrow.
And Tom, you've set this up in a way that the hospital is a neutral party watching, in some sense, the insurance companies duke it out with the professionals. But it really, in some sense, it's not that case, or maybe I've misinterpreted your position.
Right.
What role does the hospital play here, and how can they solve this?
Yeah, if I gave anyone the impression that hospitals are neutral parties in this, I want to correct that impression completely, because that's not what I was trying to say at all. What I was trying to say in part is that, first, at a minimum, there are what I'll call the typical community hospital, which, among other things, has the hospital-based specialists of anesthesia, pathology, imaging, emergency services. And for those hospitals, they may not be they're not responsible for the professional services, but they experience the consequences of how this matter plays out with their patients. And so those hospitals are very much in the middle of it. And I think those hospitals are trying to do what they can, given the nature of the relationship that exists between what I'll call the typical community hospital and their medical staff, which is largely, frankly, a matter of trying to influence and convince people to willingly go along with a particular outcome. And you get the variation that this conversation is based on. There are other organizations, and my own and others, where we do have the kind of relationship with physicians because we're healthcare services organizations providing hospital and physician services, where in the course of establishing those relationships, as was mentioned by our first speaker, that there is the opportunity in that context to have the conversation to make it a matter of contractual relationship or other vehicles that can be used so that, because you have aligned economic incentives, those aligned economic incentives in today's world are very much oriented towards meeting consumer needs. And so, that's the difference.
I see. But so if I could, let me come back to the specific thing, because we've heard, suppose there's an anesthesiology group out there, to take one example, and they're really dedicated to patient service, and they're a little frustrated with the dealings with the plans that are predominant in the market. And so they're not contracting with the two plans for which those are most of your patients.
Right.
What is the response of the hospital in that case? I mean, you could go, and Jeff, I'll give you a chance as well. Right. You could kick them out of your hospital, or you could go to the plan and say you need to have these people in. How does that get?
I won't go into all the details, but I think people generally can appreciate the benefit that can accrue to the patient in terms of both quality and efficiency of operation when there is a contract with a single anesthesia group to provide those services, as opposed to, frankly, I've been in the business almost 40 years. I've seen hospitals where it's individual, and it's chaos, frankly. It's chaos. So there's a, I think there's a very good patient interest question for why having a contract with the group. Once that's in place, I do think the hospital, either through its contracting, has a responsibility to try to secure either agreement from the anesthesiologist that they either participate in the plans that the hospital's a part of, or if they're not, because there can be reasonable disagreements that exist, effectively the anesthesia group would agree to a mechanism whereby patients who are treated under those plans aren't going to experience this surprise bill phenomena. So there are ways to deal with it.
Okay, I'm going to give Jeff a chance to respond, and then I want to bring it back to Betsy.
So I'll give you some real experience that relates to this so you can get the picture, because, again, the clinician or physician side of this is often missed. For background, I was the president of my group. I had all the interaction with the administrators, but more importantly, I was the payer liaison for all 400-plus anesthesiologists in the state of Alabama for about 12 or 13 years. And I dealt with the largest insurer in Alabama, most of you probably know who that is, on a very regular basis, as well as the Medicaid agency. Very sensitive to the issues of the payers, and we were actually told that we had the most constructive relationship with the largest payer of any specialty that they had ever dealt with. So that's kind of the background. We were not in network with all big payers. Why? We were with the largest. Why? Well, we were a group that was rock solid top to bottom, very good professional citizens involved at all level, doing good work, having good outcomes, etc. And the one particular large payer that we would never contract with only brought to the table offers that only somebody desperately in need of business would take. So if you look at data at our institution, it might draw some conclusions about the anesthesiologist not being willing to sit down at the table and negotiate, when in fact the opposite was true. I sat down and talked with them about it all the time. Before I left and moved to Texas, I was real close to having something cinched, but that was after working for a decade. And I can share stories of my colleagues in Texas that tell me the same. They're trying, but when competitive pricing isn't offered, you have to remember all physicians are private businesses as well. And in our specialty, it's crucial that we negotiate those commercial contracts well because of how poorly the government pays anesthesiologists. Facts show, the Government Accounting Office shows, affirmed, that anesthesiologists are paid lower than any specialist by Medicare, 30 cents on the dollar. Medicaid in Alabama, to use that as the example, we were the fifth lowest. We were paid, I think, $10.72 for every 15-minute unit, $10.72. So if your government-funded patient population is in the 45% range, and then you accept commercial contracts that are well below average market prices, you'll be out of business. You won't be able to recruit and retain. So if the prices that we're paid for our services are not directly related to real market value rather than artificially created values by Medicare and Medicaid, and we can get into that. The RUC does work, but they start with a budget. The Medicare and Medicaid prices are budget-driven. They are not market-driven. So there's strong argument for not using them. But again, when we're paid that low, you have to negotiate right. Some people commonly say, we hear this from the insurance lobby, oh, they commonly bill 300% higher than they should. Well, that's because you'd have to increase Medicare rates 300% to come up to commercial rates. Okay, and there's a reason why billed charges are oftentimes higher. It's because physicians throw a bill out there not having any idea sometimes what it's going to be cut to. We don't know. We can't predict what we're going to be paid. We can bill what we want to, and there doesn't seem to be a predictable, consistent amount that we'll get paid in return. There's a lot of confusion there. Lots and lots of confusion, and that's what we would like changed. Things need to be simpler. I may be the dumbest anesthesiologist in the country, but I ought to be able to figure out my estimation of benefits document that I receive 6 months later. I oftentimes can't. It took me forever to try to figure out what insurance product to buy. I thought I bought the best one, but obviously I didn't. We still got surprises.
So, Betsy, you've heard there are clearly market power issues here and policy. There's near virtual unanimity among everyone that the patient shouldn't be held responsible, which is, I think, good news for perspective. On the other hand, there are questions of the policy reforms might set up, for example, setting rates, as Jeff has argued, low rates could create problems of access. On the other hand, as Colin has pointed out, high rates could limit the ability of insurers to get discounts. Is Consumers Union, are you worried about access issues as a result of legislation, and how do you monitor those types of issues?
Yeah, we're not so worried about the access issues, although we'll, of course, be watching it, because back in California, as Tom referred to, in 2009, we resolved the emergency room issue, reimbursement issue, and didn't find that there was an access problem created. So we don't have a reason to really believe there's going to be access problems. But the marketplace is dynamic, so of course we'll be watching it closely.
I can tell everyone here that you can get an ambulance in Los Angeles, so I know that's not a worry. So
it is, but we didn't even talk about air ambulances, a whole other issue, which I know Blue Cross is looking at. You know, people getting, again, these just whatever the market will bear prices, then they're not in network, and we're talking, you know, $100,000. But if I may just comment on another thing that Jeff said. I mean, there are some points we agree on, which is about the complexity of the system for the doctors, for the patients. The tiering adds an extra layer of confusion. It's nearly impossible for anyone to figure out their insurance. That is true. The other point was that he said that there were just a few people, providers, billing at these huge rates. Well, we're not just worried about the $30,000 example that I started off with. We're talking about $100, $500, $1,300 bills, and it's all relative what's a big bill. When you're scraping by trying to make the rent and put food on the table, $100 is a lot of money, too. So as people are paying their premiums, which we all know are going up all the time, we want to make sure they're getting the value for their dollar, and even $100 more is not going to be easy for a lot of people.
Sure, I think that's right. But I think, as I noted at the introduction, and one question is, sometimes we want to use copays and deductibles, and there are places where they're appropriate. For example, we want to steer people to providers, I think, when they have a choice and when they can make an informed decision. I think the challenge here is what happens, obviously, when it's thrust upon them by the vagaries of healthcare.
That's the topic today, is when it's not their choice, when it's not an informed decision, right?
We're going to open it up to the audience for questions. We have about 15 minutes. If you could state your affiliation and then ask it in the form of a question rather than a soliloquy, we would appreciate it. So why don't we start the woman back. We'll start from the back and work our way. The woman back there with her hand on the aisle.
Thank you, sir.
Nope. In blue.
Thank you so much.
Good morning.
I try.
Karen Feldman with the AFL-CIO. Our affiliates bargain health plans. Sometimes they jointly administer them with employers. So I was sort of confused about some of the descriptions about self-funded plans and allowing states to do regulation. Could somebody explain more
about that? Yeah, I think the confusion is over ERISA and who is subject to state regulation. I don't know if Colin or Betsy wants to talk. Well, Betsy seems
to. Yeah, the Department of Labor is, you know, charged with, as I'm sure you know.
I'm an expert.
You're an expert, I know. Well, I think what the professor was.
That's not actually a question.
Do you want to address it? It's your suggestion.
Yeah.
Mark, why don't you come up? I'm going to invite Mark up for. We're going to make it a question. Now you put why on it.
And I think we need to think more about what solutions could work legally. So one is just to have new federal legislation that takes over the whole field. But we don't see that very often, and we've seen it with respect to mental health parity and with respect to coverage of first dollar coverage of preventive care. So it's not impossible, but short of that, what could be done? Well, one thing that ERISA does allow is for states to regulate provider rates. And so if they're not regulating plan payments, but provider rates, there might be some sort of regulatory vein that could be pursued. And so New York has a process where for uninsured and for those in self-funded plans, they usually we keep the patient out of it, but with respect to self-funded plans or uninsured patients, you can't. So they allow a process where the patient assigns their claim to somebody who, resolves it with the provider, and that apparently could be done under ERISA.
Thank you. I think we want to take some more questions. So the woman with her hand up in the middle of the... Your left. Right in front of you.
Right.
I give up.
There we go.
Thanks. Alwyn Castle with Policy Translation. And I have a question, but I have a clarification that I'd like to make first. You guys, I know we're talking about surprise medical bills, the anesthesiologist, the pathologist bill that I have no idea that I'm going to go out of network on. But I think there's an upstream problem that you're not talking about that is related, and that is you're assuming that I as a consumer, in a PPO, it can make an informed choice to go out of network, and I would say, no, I can't, because I can't get Mr. Drozdowski to tell me what his out-of-network payment rates are based on. So I can't make an informed choice. I'm covered by Anthem through a Fortune 50 employer and have had the experience of going out of network knowingly to find that when I get the bill for that service, the out-of-network allowed amount is less than Medicare, less than what Fair Health allows. And then when I try to get a question from Anthem or get an answer from Anthem about what, how do you base your out-of-network payments, they say, oh, well, you'll have to call.
Okay. What the question is clear. Colin. I think, do you want me to summarize, and I'll go with Jeff?
Yeah, if you want to, I'm happy to.
She wants to know how much you pay for pathology.
I like your question better, but that was not what I heard. First of all, let me acknowledge that all health plans need to do a better job at informing consumers. I'm not going to shy away from that point, ma'am. It's a valid point. There are complexities that make it nearly impossible. We can tell what we will allow in a non-emergency, out-of-network situation. What we cannot tell you is what will you then be balance billed on top of that. That becomes an issue between you and the rendering provider, because by definition, they're not in-network. They can say, well, I need X amount of money for this, and Anthem will say, we will allow Y, and you can have that negotiation. Depending on the service, we have that ability today, but we also don't know in advance exactly what it is the provider will be billing. And so when they have the specifics of the bill, it's then easier to say, this is how much we're going to allow. But it's not as easy as saying, well, you're going to have your knee replaced. Well, what exactly is going to occur in that episode is a challenge. I'm not defending the fact that we need to provide more information, because we do. We need to have better tools as an industry. We do. But it also is dependent on knowing exactly what it is you're going to have and what that provider will bill.
Can I just follow up?
No, I'm actually going to let Jeff follow up, and then if I'm sorry.
I might actually help you. I love your question, because I've been in that position. And I'll defend the insurance companies a little bit, because one of the problems is just human factor science. A lot of people, even if the information was there, don't dig for it, don't look for it. It's only, they back shelf it. They don't need it. Life's busy. Everything's going on fast. Then all of a sudden they need it. They're calling in an urgent situation. They can't get the information for one reason or another, or there's not time to. So that's one thing. I get that. It is really, really hard, and I think it's really impractical to think that the average person again, my wife and I are not, we're pretty savvy consumers, especially as it relates to this. We couldn't get the information we wanted. The information we got was grossly inadequate. So everybody put that away. I have a hard time finding out what the allowable is. So if you look at the right-hand corner of the graph in the white paper, bottom right-hand corner, or really the right-hand margin, you think about a PPO where patients are agreeing to pay more money to have more flexibility to go out of network, to choose their institution and their providers, and then look at the numbers. Right off the bat, the $10,000 is discounted 60% to $4,000. I don't know how that happens, why it happens, who decides. I think it's random. Not random, but it's unilaterally decided by the insurance company, but I don't have say-so. The patient doesn't have say-so. And then if you look at the worst-case scenario, the amount of money that that patient knowingly paid more insurance for is really, in the end, costing them an exorbitant amount of money. The complexity is at the root of the problem. Surprise bills are coming because the products are so complex and confusing, the average person can't figure it out. And if you look at in California, yes, there was a huge complaint brought by the payers and the consumer advocates that 30% of people were getting surprise bills. It's super important to analyze what surprise means. So the California legislature sought a solution, and they commissioned their own study. And of all those cases they looked at, the 30%, guess how many were truly caused by being out of network by the providers? 0.2 to 0.3%. All the rest of them were surprises because of the big deductibles, co-pays, allowables, denied care, etc. They got a huge bill. They're paying insurance, but geez, I just got care, and I've got a bill that I got to pay that's thousands of dollars. That's the problem.
I think, you know, there's a broader question of price transparency that we could debate. I think what we've seen from Neeraj Sood's work on this topic is that some consumers are able to do this type of price shopping and would like access, but for most consumers who are sick and getting care for the first time, it's hard to do that type of shopping. We're going to go with Norm Payson here in the front, and then we'll come over here.
I'm Norm Payson. I have multiple categories of as a person. I'm a past practicing doc and was in the health plan industry, et cetera. Dana, this may be a question for you. Because I know you're so good at the analytical aspect, and is also perhaps for Professor Hall. Has there been any scoring as a percentage of premium in these different subcategories, whether it's surprise bill, non-par, delta between par and non-par, delta between allowable, et cetera, or if AB 72 comes into California, what will be the scoring that Anthem and other insurers would have, and then also the scoring of how that's going to affect the tilt between ERISA and non-ERISA. Will this encourage more ERISA plans to go fully insured because they're going to tilt in where they have a ceiling on par? So just wing out some economic questions.
So the physician is asking about the analytics, and the answer is none of us thought to do it until just now. But it's a very good question. There's a question over here, please. Thank you.
Sharif Zafran, I'm a physician from Texas. I'm actually an anesthesiologist. Dr. Plagenhoff, you talked a little bit about solving the problem through network adequacy and increased transparency and through fair payment. Can you describe a little bit exactly who and how would figure what exactly a fair payment is?
Sure, that's a great question. I think the New York legislation gives you an example of how you can have fair payment determined. So you got to understand or think about the history of what happened in New York. There was a big lawsuit, the Ingenix lawsuit, and a large, well-known payer was found to be doing their calculation of UCR internally, non-transparently, and they were found to be manipulating the data for their own financial benefit. So the result of that lawsuit was they had to pay $95 million to create an unbiased, market-related database of billed charges, real data, what people are billing. It's called Fair Health. And so the way that we could comprehensively fix this, whether it's at the state level or the federal level, is to agree to pay out-of-network providers a percentile of fair health. One of the other speakers said, the professor, I think, said 75%, 85%. Some people are advocating for 80% of fair health. Now, payers say, oh, those are, you know, not related to meaningful data, and that will just drive up costs. So in California, they looked at that, and they studied that, and they found that the 80th percentile of billed charges actually correlated with somewhere between 5 to 10% higher than in-network rates. So ask yourself, what would prevent insurance companies and physicians from being in this scenario? Well, if insurance companies had to pay slightly more for people to be out of network, they wouldn't want people to be out of network, because the more that are in network, the more money they'd save. The beauty of using the 80th percentile of fair health, or an agreed upon percentile, would be that not only is there a guarantee that physicians will be paid for their services in a meaningful, fair market value supported way that won't negatively impact access, but the beauty is, when you're talking about the outliers, if the payment for the out-of-network physician who might have billed exorbitantly is based on 80th percentile of billed charges in a particular geozone of where people provide the same care, then that would be a way of nipping that in the bud as well. So it would play well on both ends.
I would like to make just a couple of quick comments about that. We are very supportive of working with regulators, working with providers for a solution, but to index it in any manner purely to charges is not logical. And with all due respect, a few minutes earlier you sat here and said, I don't know what I charge, I just sort of put it out there. And so...
No, I know what I charge.
But that was what you did say. You said, I throw it out there.
Charges
are not reflective of costs. And as the professor noted, it is very common for providers to bill 3, 4, 5 times what they regularly accept as payment in full, and what is exponentially more than what they accept from Medicare. And so I would respectfully submit that if you're advocating for something that is a function of a charge structure that is not well understood and that can be increased simply by every year increasing your charges, if you hold at 80%, a provider increases charges by 10% per year, 80% goes up by 10%, and there's nothing that can be done about it.
Betsy?
Yeah, this is a point on which we agree with the plans completely. And I would say that California did study it, and it's a sticking point, and not just in California, but in every state, about what is the fair and reasonable reimbursement going to be for out-of-network providers. But after studying it and looking at fair health, California landed in a different place, which is the greater of the average contracted rate, or Medicare plus 125% of Medicare. And we do want to get that Goldilocks point at which we're encouraging providers to contract, and it's a balancing act. Not every state lands in the same place, but we did study it and looked at fair health and decided not to go that way.
We have a question. Mark?
Can I just comment on that really quick? Yeah, 2 points I forgot to make about this very debate. One is that we might conceivably, and due to the complexity, unfortunately adding more complexity, arrive at different balancing points in different areas. And so the extent of the relationship between charges and contracted rates in Medicare might reflect a certain average in one geography, but that average might vary widely from one specialty to another or among geographies, which makes it that much trickier and scares off regulators, but it's the reality. The other point is, whatever you start with, we very much believe that it needs to continue to monitor, and we have a couple of good examples in Maryland and Colorado where they started with something, but they said, we don't know if it's going to be too hot or too cold or just right. So every 2 years we go back in and look, what's the effect on network composition? What are we hearing about the provider negotiations? What's the impact on access and what have you? So absolutely whatever we do needs sort of continuing sort of evaluation and fine-tuning.
Sure. Yeah, we can't get it right out of the gate. This is going to be our last question in the back here, Mike Ryan.
Mike Ryan, BMS. First of all, I'd compliment Brookings and the Schaefer Center for taking this subject matter on. It really is important for the nation. I would say the following. My question is the following. It's really, Dana, for you and for Professor Hall, which is what we hear when we survey patients and talk to patients is more and more what we're seeing is patients who are deciding to delay procedures, to not undergo required services and other things because they are frightened of their insurance. They don't the high deductibles. They don't understand the tiering. They don't understand this issue of out of network as well. And so they're tending to use their insurance more and more as catastrophic insurance. And I guess my question is, from an academic perspective, has anyone bothered to really study what the healthcare burden of that is over time of people electing not to get the care that they need?
I'll start just by pointing out that I really want to thank the audience for pointing out things we don't answer rather than things we answer. It's much appreciated. Betsy, why don't you start?
But there is some work on this. Rand years ago studied high deductible plans just a couple years ago and did find, as you're saying, people are delaying care. They're not getting the preventive care. I'm not sure that actually went as far as getting to the health impact.
It does. So a good example, and Neeraj Sood is here, and he'll comment in a minute, but when you look at high deductible plans, when we studied them, a lot of them have carve-outs for preventive services, but what you find is people don't use those services, even though they're free. And so the point is they don't really understand the plans. Neeraj, do you have a different view since you've written on high deductible plans? Why don't you come up as well? And then I'll invite all the audience to come up afterwards. Actually, at that point, we're going to stop.
Then we can go sit out there.
Everyone gets the mic here at Brookings. That's always been the theme.
So, yeah, we've analyzed data from, you know, for 40 or 50 large employers to look at the effects of high deductible plans. And what we find is that over a three-year period, they do save costs. But people save costs primarily by just cutting down on use of both needed and unneeded care. So we see declines in use of medications for chronic illness. So rather than say, you know, go towards a generic, they just stop taking their meds. We see people getting mammograms in December when they know they're gonna be in a high deductible plan in January. Even though in January the mammogram is gonna be free for them, they don't realize that. So they're, you know, you see the spike up in preventive care prior to joining. So in some sense, consumers are smart, but in some sense, health insurance is just too complicated for them. So they're trying to make smart decisions, but it's difficult for them to make smart decisions.
Okay, thank you, Neeraj. And I want to give each of you a minute to make a last concluding remark on this topic. So Betsy, we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, this has been a lively discussion. I really appreciate it. You, I think, have gotten a flavor of the complexity of all this. As I say, we need policy solutions in this area, and legislation is the art of the possible. So we're going to aim high, but we may have to take this step by step, and hope we will in the coming year.
Thank you. Tom?
Yeah, well, the die is cast to a certain degree in California with AB 72. So I think that, but like someone just made, I think, a comment, you know, people tend to think that once legislation is done, the process ends. It just begins. Look at the Affordable Care Act as maybe the poster child for that. So I think everybody needs to keep their eye on what the implications of this are, study it, understand it, and be open to making the adjustments that otherwise ultimately look to be indicated. That may be the biggest challenge.
Colin?
I would simply say that forums like this and open and honest communications are necessary. I think if you've heard and learned nothing from this, this is complicated. And clearly, the best solution will come from collaborative dialogue with the parties, the providers, the members, the consumers, the employers. We're committed to that, and I think it's essential to get to a sustainable solution to this issue.
Jeff?
Thanks. We physicians are committed to being at the table, and we admit that we actually haven't been or haven't been there well organized. But that is changing right now, this year. We are coming together to stand up and fight for solutions that make sense. You can't base what was done in some states on necessarily the argument that it was the best thing. What we have seen in the states, and everybody in D.C. certainly knows how lobbying impacts what gets done and unions and things. In California, for instance, a lot of influence was weighed in the end by the labor unions, had a lot of influence on what got done. Excuse me. So heretofore, a lot of money's been spent in the state houses deciding what to do. Physicians haven't showed up in big numbers. There are states where one doctor shows up to give the other side. Hearing from everybody is important. We want to be at the table. We are here to protect patients' rights. We want people to have good insurance, good health care, and we want it to make sense. We want it to be affordable. And I'm going to make one more plug for Fair Health. I think the numbers that were stated had more to do with Medicare than commercial insurance. Again, you should expect large multiples of billed charges as compared to Medicare, because Medicare and Medicaid are based on government budgets, not on market values. If you limit payment based on government budgets, you will negatively impact access to care. So realize that just because California didn't use Fair Health and they used a multiple of Medicare doesn't mean that it was smart or that Fair Health is bad. I will argue that there is a correlation. The facts show that in the analysis in California and in Texas, those numbers were meaningful. The insurance lobby continues to say that they're unmeaningful and 400, 500, 600% above what it should be. But that's compared to Medicare. So you got to be a savvy consumer, and we need everybody at the table aware of all of these details. Right now, there are examples of states where decisions have been made because of one-sided lobbying, quite frankly. So let's be smart about this for the American people.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Those disparate opinions.
Oh, no question about it.
Colin, nice to meet you. Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Sorry, I see you.
No, you're not at all.
He's not getting away with it. But if my question didn't get answered, I know how to find out what the provider is. I can't figure out how to find out what the provider is.
I don't have some PhD, right? Yeah, I just mastered it. I enjoyed your humor.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we got to.
You have to, right? You can't laugh and shouldn't be doing it.
For better or worse, we have one in California now. Like I said, my opinion is that once
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, that's okay.
It's
okay. Take care.
I'm glad to know I didn't break.
No, it's fine.
I looked at it.
You're good. Thank you.
And I know you know about employer plans because you worked with Joanne and now you've got Daria.
Yep, absolutely.
And it gets complicated.
It does get very complicated.
That's why he's my friend.
Microphones are hot, okay?
You got it.
Okay. So this is where we talk about everything.
They're looking at me and you right now.
Are you in?
Okay. Microphones are hot, okay?
Thank you.
Say is going out to the audience.
Good to know.
Okay.
This makes the panel much less fun beforehand.
Microphones hot, okay?
All right.
You can hear me and you talking.
Try not to say anything embarrassing.
Since I'm down every little week, I can DC home.
Microphones are home. Okay.
Makes up for small town life.
I think I'll call them.
If you jump off, don't remember your mic.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Is there going to be one more or that's it?
Yeah,
there's going to be one more.
Oh, wait, no, we do have
one more.
Yeah. Appreciate if people could take their seats. We'd like to get this panel started. Neeraj, could you come up and be mic'd? Okay, well, this is the second panel. And this is going to talk about policy. There's no sound.
It's there.
Okay.
People are talking. It's there.
Yeah. Is there a problem?
It's there.
It's okay.
Hey, Neeraj. Nice to meet you.
A lot of people are talking.
Sure. If everyone could please be quiet. Okay, I hear it now. That's better. This is the second panel. It's going to be focused on policy. And this panel has a combination of policy makers and policy thinkers, and actually everyone on the panel is a mix of policymakers and policy thinkers. But here's what we're going to do. Jack Hoadley from Georgetown University is going to speak about state policy in this area. He's going to really be reflecting how state policymakers approach this issue. What are they attempting to do? What do they find, feasible to do? What more would they like to do but are finding it very difficult? Matt Fiedler, who is on the Council of Economic Advisors, is going to talk about federal policy. Some of the proposals that the Obama administration has put forward recently and other ideas where the federal government can do things. Then Zach Cooper and Neeraj Sood, who are both economists, they're both going to present additional ideas for policy to address this issue of surprise medical billing. So, Jack, could you begin?
Okay. Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And I think it's really helpful to have this session on a very important issue of surprise billing. In 2015, my Georgetown colleagues, Kevin Lucia and Sandy Ahn, and I looked at what protections some states are offering to consumers in surprise billing situations. And this was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and in turn built on a 2009 study we did for the California Healthcare Foundation. And so in looking at these issues, we looked at the variety of scenarios for balanced billing that you've already heard about this morning, and really found that for the most part, states are focusing on two of those scenarios, either the billing that occurs in emergency situations or the surprise billing, usually the situations where people are in network hospitals but are getting some portion of their care from an out-of-network physician or other provider, and whether that's, they've managed to schedule the surgeon who's in-network, but it's the anesthesiologist or the radiologist or some other consulting physician or an assistant surgeon that turns out to be out-of-network, or whether it's some other type of care situation where, again, we all know if you've been in the hospital, there are a variety of doctors who come in just to visit you and check up on what you're doing, and you really don't know why they're there, who they are, and some of them turn out to be out of network. Legislation, for the most part, does not deal with scenarios where you're intentionally picking an out-of-network obstetrician to deliver your child or other situations like that where hopefully you're well-informed, although some of the transparency issues will deal with that. Or we don't mostly talk here about some of the issues around some of the gaps in networks or transportation or lab services or some of the other issues that do also come up. But mostly what we've seen are state efforts to look at those two scenarios. About three-quarters of the states really have no specific statutory consumer protections, although some may have related policies such as disclosure rules or transparency, but don't sort of deal with the core of the issue that, as we've been talking about it here. For the 12 or so states that do have some kind of legislative solution that's relatively comprehensive, most of them have various of the elements that we've heard talked about already this morning. The disclosure and transparency requirements that are often viewed, and as Mark Hall said, you know, in his paper, necessary but not sufficient for dealing with this issue. They also have elements in most cases of some kind of prohibition on balanced billing aimed at the providers, aimed at sort of protecting the consumer by not allowing bills to be sent. Some of the states have elements of hold harmless to require the insurers to make sure that no bill comes to the consumer. And I'll come back and talk about sort of the balancing of those two things. And then most of them have some provision around the adequate payment kinds of issues that we've been talking about a fair amount already this morning. Some way to get the payment right, whether it's some form of rate setting using one of those standards around Medicare, Fair Health, other kinds of UCR standards, or some type of mediation or dispute resolution provision. So what I want to mostly talk about is some of the political considerations that have come up as states have tried to deal with these things, and really helps part to explain why 12 states or so have done something, why three-quarters of the states have not. And we really are in a situation, and I think it was very well illustrated in the previous panel, where there are competing incentives. There's often a broad agreement from all parties, and again, we heard that again this morning, that the consumer should be kept out of the picture. But the problem is, unless you create the mechanism to do that, it's hard to get to that point. You have the insurers who don't want to see a sort of hold harmless approach. They don't want to be left holding the bag and paying whatever the charges are. We've got the providers who want to sort of maintain their rate structure that they've set for good reasons, and not want to be subject to what in some instances has been very low UCR kind of rates, usual and customary rates set by insurers. And so that creates sort of the tension that we're operating under in the competing incentives. None of them want to be the bad guy. None of them want to look like the person who is causing the consumer to be left holding the bag. And so what states have to do in these situations depends a lot on the market and the political environments in which they operate. And so I think of some of the things that we've seen as we've talked to legislators, to stakeholders, to legislators in the different states where we've looked at these things. And often it's the concentration of the provider or the insurance industry or both. So in a state where you have one large dominant insurer, the environment's going to play out differently than if you have a larger array of competing insurers. It's going to affect the underlying negotiations with providers. That's going to set the framework in which the rates situation exists. Or concentration on the provider side. If you have dominant provider groups, we know there are some states where all the members of a particular specialty may be affiliated with one provider group, and they exercise leverage that affects things. And all of these things come into the situation where the political environment, the policymakers, have to have a recognition that any solution they do operates in the context of those provider and insurer market situations and can potentially affect network negotiations and the other kinds of relationships between those things. So you do something to set a particular provision to protect the consumer in a balanced billing situation, you're going to influence potentially all the kinds of negotiations that exist out there between providers and insurers. The political influence of the stakeholders matters a lot too. So you've got states where traditionally in the lobbying process, maybe the medical association is really viewed as that one powerful lobby you don't want to get on the wrong side of. or the health plan, or the one large health plan if it's a concentrated kind of thing. So again, they operate in a unique political environment that's different than what we sometimes see here in Washington, and maybe different from the state across the border. Obviously, the difference is also in the recognition of consumer interest in this, how much they're active, the consumer groups are active, and media attention. I think you'd find that a lot of the states that have dealt with these things have dealt with it because there's been media attention, perhaps to just one dramatic case, perhaps to a series of cases, but often that kind of puts the issue up on the agenda. So going beyond that, you have to think about the role of political leadership and how that plays in and the different ways that operates in states. Recently in Florida, where I had a chance to be down there for a little bit of their process, you know, it was interesting because it was the Office of the Insurance Consumer Advocate, a state office, a state official, that kind of took it upon herself to play a role in trying to get something done on this. And so she developed some of the case studies that were out there. She convened a couple of hearings to try to bring some attention to the issue. She helped to work with some of the stakeholders to try to do some kind of model legislation that can go towards the legislature. And this is an office that not a lot of people necessarily are aware of, but at least in Florida, this was a particular part of the state administration that came out and tried to play a role. And then it was a member of the majority party, the Republicans in Florida, that decided to try to champion this bill. And as somebody said this morning, this isn't necessarily a red or a blue or a purple issue. Here was a case in Florida where it was a Republican legislature who sort of took the leadership role, a fairly powerful Republican legislature in a state where it's a majority Republican legislature. And he really tried to play the role of trying to lead this coalition. The first year, in 2015, when they tried to do it, it failed. They ran into some significant pushback from some of the provider groups in Florida, and that ground the process to a halt. But they came back, and that's where the consumer advocate and the insurance consumer advocate came back and tried to reignite the issue for 2016, get things started again. The same legislator was willing to pick up the mantle and move forward. And what they did was they found some adjustments to make from the bill that was traveling in 2015, which have ended up being just enough to get past the political opposition that had been raised the first year. And so it is this kind of circumstance that plays out. Again, you're all here in Washington, you're people who watch the political and the policy process. None of this is any great surprise, but part of it is how it plays out in the particular situations in particular state at a given moment. California went through a two-year cycle as well. 2015, unsuccessful. 2016, successful. Again, there were adjustments made to the legislation. There was compromise. Betsy talked about this morning that she talked about things that started out looking for one way, and as I understand it, and I haven't followed the California as much, but in the end, some of the lead provider groups and some of the lead insurance groups stayed at least neutral in terms of their public positions, and that allowed the legislative process to go forward. New Jersey failed. Large pushback from a major provider group in the state that, and again, I don't know the specific political dynamics that were playing out there, but they were successful in stopping that effort in New Jersey. In New York, it seems like it was much more of a process driven by some of the political leadership who then convened stakeholders from across the spectrum, convened the insurers, the providers, the consumers, the different categories within those groups, and tried to figure out what elements could come together and form the basis for a compromise. So again, political leadership finding a way to come to some neutral position that involved. And what they did was to provide some things that helped different groups. Connecticut, I think, had a similar process to what went on in New York. We also took a look at one state, in particular New Mexico, where there is no legislation. And what's interesting there is that the environment was different. So we were told by folks in New Mexico that there were relatively few providers. It's a relatively small state. Health plans typically had contracts with most providers that practice medicine in the state. And so that right there meant there were fewer opportunities for balanced billing, surprise billing to exist. Problems were infrequent, but also there was a spirit of when a problem does arise, let's see if we can come up with an informal arrangement and people can talk. And we heard some of this from the folks we talked to in New York in terms of the history there. The history had been, you know, the provider and the insurer, they get together, they see each other on the golf course or at some reception. They say, you know, we've got a problem, let's get on the phone tomorrow and see if we could work it out. And it got worked out. But I think what we're starting to see is those sort of, and in New Mexico, that was sort of the basis for, we don't really need legislation because mostly this, there isn't much of a problem, and when there is, we can work out. But I think what we're seeing is that that environment is what's changing. And the politics is changing in the sense that we're seeing more of the narrow network kinds of arrangements. That means there's more opportunities for surprise billing. If there are more frequent situations where you go into the hospital and there will be a physician you meet who's not in the plan's network. We've got more consolidation of insurers and providers of both sides, and so that means they have more economic market pressure to bear in those negotiations. And I think more generally the negotiations over networks and rates in this environment have gotten more difficult. So whether in fact we see more total balance billing, I think is hard to measure, but we are seeing some of the conditions that can lend itself to these problems. I'll wrap up with one last thought, which is I think that it's still very early to judge the success of what's done. New York has only been in effect a couple of years. Obviously, California is not even in effect yet. It's just been passed. But I think it will be important to monitor, and as somebody said this morning, to make the possibility of adjustments. And one of the things we have seen in the dozen or so states that have these laws on the books, they have gone back, and Florida had a law that covered some situations. What they came back was to cover more. California had some situations covered. They came back to cover more or to fix things. And so it is an evolving process, and I think that's kind of where things sit.
Thanks, Jack. One follow-up. You had mentioned that how consolidated the providers or the insurers are has an effect, but you didn't say what the effect is. So if it's consolidated, you're likely to see more of a concern about surprise billing and also the likelihood of addressing it.
Yeah, I think that's it's both of those factors. I think as you see consolidated providers, there are going to be tougher negotiations, maybe more situations where networks aren't as inclusive as we heard about in New Mexico. And then if they've got that sort of economic power, that's often going to translate to political power that says, you know, do it our way or no way. And so I think it has both sort of the market effects and creating the situations, but also sometimes making solutions more challenging.
Thank you. Matt Fiedler?
Thank you for having me. It's been an interesting conversation so far, and I look forward to seeing the rest of it. So I want to open just with a sort of quick CEA view on what the economic case is for sort of policy intervention in this area. You know, I think there's a pretty strong economic case that patients just shouldn't be in the middle here. You know, cost sharing has a real role to play in health insurance by encouraging consumers to be cost conscious when they seek medical care, and that includes sort of the choice between a lower cost in-network provider and a higher cost out-of-network provider. But we also know from the sort of standard economic analysis of insurance that, you know, cost sharing has a downside. It means that the patient is exposed to a portion of the financial risk associated with getting sick and needing care, and so that cost sharing should really be focused on the circumstances where that financial incentive can encourage a more efficient or cost-conscious decision. The circumstances we're talking about today are just not one of those circumstances for the most part, cases where the patient sort of is in a poor position to influence whether they end up with, in the emergency case, certainly very little influence at all, and then the sort of out-network specialist and an in-network facility sort of fairly limited influence. So when you're talking about one of these situations where the patient, not a lot is in the patient's control, the sort of economic case for why an insurance product should include cost sharing in these cases is fairly limited. So that creates a little bit of a sort of, if you're an economist, a little bit of a puzzle as to sort of why do we see all these contracts out in the world that don't provide this protection. And I think this sort of discussion so far has touched on a few different things, but I want to sort of pull out what I think probably the two sort of key components are. I think the one which came up in the first panel is that choosing among insurance products is complex. Even sort of the choosing among the basics of the cost sharing and network designs of different plans is a difficult decision for consumers in and of itself. The sort of third order question of, okay, you know, how what's going to happen if I'm at an in-network facility and there's an out-of-network physician is probably just realistically not something that's ever going to make the consumer checklist when choosing among two insurance plans. And even if we were in a situation where you know, that wasn't the consumer checklist, I think, you know, verifying that prospectively is likely to be pretty hard. So that means that we're in a situation where the sort of market signal from the consumer to the plan in terms of what the plan design should look like is going to be fairly weak, and it's, you know, maybe not surprising that that the sort of marketplace has not solved this problem. I think there's a sort of another important component here, which also came up in the first panel, which is that you know, the plans are legitimately in a difficult position here vis-a-vis the providers, and that if they are simply told that they need to cover these costs, their bargaining position in terms of what that rate ultimately looks like is very limited, and that's ultimately also going to have consequences for the consumers at the end of the day, because they're going to, you know, bear that cost in the form of higher premiums. So, you know, an indication that we sort of the need for being thoughtful in how we craft solutions here. So turning to solutions a little bit, there have been a lot of ideas put forward, and I think this discussion is a really helpful one because, as people have said, this is a complex issue, and I think there's additional thinking that needs to be done. I want to provide a quick overview of sort of what the administration has already done in this area, and then what the sort of natural next steps look like from the administration's perspective. So with respect to plans offered through the health insurance marketplace, individual market plans, we have some tools that allow us to make progress administratively. So I think one of the important ones is starting last year, marketplace plans in the healthcare.gov states have been required to provide sort of public information, detailed searchable information on their provider networks, which makes it easier for consumers to actually figure out who's in network, who's out of network. I think there are circumstances where that solves the problem. I think most of the circumstances we're talking about today are probably that's not the most relevant solution, but it is it does in cases where there is some element of choice, but there was no information to facilitate that choice before, make things somewhat easier. I think the second thing that the administration has done, and this will take effect for the 2018 plan year, as many people probably know, the Affordable Care Act requires all private insurance plans to place a limit on annual out-of-pocket spending. Generally speaking, that limit on annual out-of-pocket spending only applies to in-network services, which in these circumstances, you know, we really want to make sure that people do have protection against catastrophic costs. It's one of the sort of core functions of health insurance, even in these out-of-network scenarios. So starting in 2018, that limit, again, for marketplace plans, is going to also apply to out-of-network charges at in-network out-of-network charges associated with care at in-network facilities in instances where the patient wasn't prospectively notified that there was a risk of the out-of-network charge in that circumstance. So, you know, we think that these are both important steps forward, but you know, I think we agree with the conversation on the earlier panel that there is a need for sort of more comprehensive steps in this area, right? These are regulatory tools that only affect the individual market. So, you know, and so there probably is need for legislative action here that will sweep in the employer market, but also I think to, you know, one of the rationales that in the earlier panel, the rationale for federal action here is that will not only affect the state-regulated sort of small group and large group markets, but also sweep in self-insured plans as well. So the president's fiscal year 2017 budget included a proposal along these lines, targeted specifically at the circumstance of, again, the sort of in-network facility, out-of-network physician case, and it would have had sort of approached the problem in two ways. First is it provided a requirement that in-network facilities take reasonable steps to match patients to in-network physicians. So, you know, we know there are, the data presented earlier, there are some cases where there's no in-network physician at a facility, but in many cases there are. And it is, you know, it's important and in the interest of the consumer in those circumstances that people be thinking about that matching process in a sensible way. There are going to be cases where that matching process is not successful for some reason. And so the second prong of the proposal require physicians who regularly practice as a facility to accept an in-network rate for the services provided, ensuring that, you know, even in the cases where the matching wasn't successful, consumers aren't going to bear that out-of-network cost in those situations, whether it's indirectly as cost-sharing or directly as cost-sharing or balanced billing, or indirectly through higher premiums that they're paying down the line because the plan's been stuck with the bill. So the goal here, the fundamental principle that I think there's been a lot of agreement on, is making sure consumers are protected. So in any case, that is sort of where the administration is at this point, and look forward to the rest of the discussion.
Yeah, Matt, any comments on the proposals of the administration? Any comments on how they've been received, interest in Congress?
Obviously, I think this event and what we see out in the press indicates that there's a lot of interest in this issue. I think in terms of, you know, what the near-term prospects are, I don't have a great sense of sort of actually the Hill dynamics on this one. So.
Have you seen the nonpartisan attitude that Jack reported in the states in the federal level?
I think we have gotten the sense that this is an issue that is hopefully disconnected at least to some degree over the sort of from the sort of more acrimonious discussions over the ACA, and that it's a problem that we sort of people understand has existed for a long time, and that we can hopefully work together to find a solution to.
Okay, thank you. Zach?
Great. Well, thanks, and thanks, everyone, for coming. You know, this is a topic I care a lot about. We're doing a fair bit of research on it, and what we're starting to see is that surprise out-of-network billing happens, I think, way more frequently than we expect, and that the cost to consumers is pretty big. I'm hoping the research will be out in the sort of short term here. And, you know, I think talking about surprise out in network billing gets me sort of one part angry and four parts pretty optimistic. I think the anger is just that this exists, you know, and I think we need to keep in mind that there's pretty good data from the Federal Reserve that basically half of folks in the U.S. can't afford a $400 surprise expense without taking on debt or selling assets or really getting into financial distress. And so you have these people out there who are facing real financial harm. And the sort of stakeholders, you've got doctors on the one hand who are the highest paid professionals in the U.S., you've got hospitals who are doing pretty darn well, and you've got big insurance companies. And I think this is one of those things that just frustrates people, right? So here are these consumers that are really struggling, and all these interest groups are saying, yeah, it's a big problem, but it's really complicated. And I think we fundamentally just need to fix it. I think the optimism comes in that there are a lot of things in healthcare that are very tough to solve and maybe darn near impossible. I think this is one where it is a solvable issue. And I think where economics can come in is by saying, well, why does it happen? Why does it persist? And then what do we do? And I think fundamentally, out-of-network billing comes up because for certain aspects of healthcare, emergency services or anesthesiology, for example, the physician's buying a package, the patient's buying a package that includes the physician and the facility. Right? So they're not buying these two services separately. Yet the way we contract is those two parts apart. And that's fundamentally the issue. And so what ends up happening is normally in most markets in healthcare, the physician faces this choice about whether or not to join a network. And if they join a network, they might face lower rates, but they're going to get more volume. The challenge is when we think about out-of-network billing where the patient doesn't have choice, where there are these physicians that you can't plan for, you can't avoid. What ends up happening is that the physician in that case can basically charge whatever they want. They don't have to participate in a network, and if they don't participate in a network, there's no consequence on their volume. Right? So the same competition that applies to almost every other physician group out there doesn't apply in these cases. And so the question is like how we bring the market discipline to bear on this space. I think the second question is why does it persist? Right? Why does this keep happening? And I think fundamentally what we have is this sort of multiple equilibria problem, where nobody wants to act first, right? So if you're a hospital and you're the first one to crack down, you're basically going to lose your physicians. And if you're an insurer and you go out and you say, this is terrible, we're going to crack down the hospitals, you're going to lose your hospitals. And so nobody wants to move first. And I think that, in particular, is why we need to see both state and federal action. Now, when we think about the policy, I think we all agree it should protect consumers, and that's frankly what most of the states have been doing. To steal Collins' language, it's addressing a symptom, right? So whenever you have these policies that focus on protecting the consumer, it's sort of after the fact. And then you get into this debate about how you set the rates. You got sort of three options, right? One's the hold harmless view, where you just force the insurers to pay it. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because then no physician ever has an incentive to join a network, and then the insurers ultimately pass the higher rates on to consumers. You can go the sort of Maryland approach and set some rate as a percentage of Medicare, and you worry about supply issues. Maybe you set the reimbursement too low. Or you go the New York route and you have mediation or baseball rules or whatever you want to call it. And the challenge is that's like clunky and cumbersome. So what's the solution? I think what it fundamentally needs to be is addressing the problem. And I think what we need to say, for example, is some form of, hospitals, look, you're required to sell a bundle. Right? If you're going to be providing anesthesia, if you're going to be providing emergency services, you got to sell a package. And that package has to include physician and facility services. Right? We can't have this world where we have some element that's chosen that includes two things that we're contracting over separately. And I think the really nice thing about that sort of package idea, first of all, is it gets you around this issue of separately going after fully insured and self-insured products. Right? So you don't have that division anymore. What you're regulating is the unit. The second is it preserves competition. Right? So hospitals are still going to compete over price and quality to get patients and to join networks. Hospitals are also going to compete to attract physicians, the same way they compete now over the wages they give to nurses. Physicians are going to still have to compete in order to get jobs working in hospitals or contracting. We can figure out different ways for that negotiation or that engagement to happen. If Cedar and Tom want to employ physicians, they can do it. If they want to contract, they can do that too. And physicians will compete over that. And at the end of the day, insurers will compete over the breadth of their networks, the quality of their product, and their premiums. And so you end up seeing competition preserved at each of these levels. And I think, again, the fundamental issue here is that the nature of this service just looks different. And unless we sort of target that and bring in competition, we're going to keep sort of playing second best. Well, we hold the patient harmless, but we end up seeing what we saw in the first panel was this like perpetual debate over what the level of the prices should be.
Zach, follow up. So you're talking about why this world that you sketched hasn't happened and the virtues of it happening. What steps would have to be taken to bring it about?
This is where economists have an advantage, right? I work where the rubber meets the sky, so I can look at the folks out there, and you can turn it into law. I mean, I think fundamentally it's states, in my view, regulating the package of what gets sold, and so basically saying I would start with emergency services, and if I were in a state house, I'd go out and say, look, the deal is if you're a hospital and you're going to sell emergency services, what you're selling is a package. And it's just that simple. And the hospitals can decide how they build the package. Again, they can salary the physicians. They can contract with physicians to provide it. But we're going to get out of this sort of crazy world where we've got physicians billing you and hospitals billing you for a unit that you're not split over. I mean, the analogy here is like if I took somebody here out to dinner tonight, we went to a nice restaurant in town, spent $100, guy brings me bread, we eat the bread, and about a month later, I get a $10,000 bill from the bread guy, right? And I didn't choose it, it just sort of showed up, and he threatened to send it to collection if I didn't pay, right? That's just a ludicrous way to buy food, right? And in a sense, we've institutionalized that in healthcare. And the question is, what you should really be paying for is the unit, not the individual components. And I think, again, it should not be an issue about debating the hold harmless and how the rates get paid. It should be debating about how we create a unit and then how we price that unit in the marketplace.
Thanks. Now we'll go to Neeraj Sood.
So I have the privilege of being the fourth economist to talk on this topic. So I'm going to tell you a lot of new things. Just a disclaimer that unlike some of the other panelists, I really started thinking about this specific issue. I've done a lot of research on health insurance more broadly, but about this specific issue about 3 weeks ago when Paul asked me to be on this panel. So the way I approached it, as a professor was, first, why does this occur? Because in some sense, if you want to craft a solution to a problem, you need to understand why it happens. And I came up with four reasons why it might be happening. The first is, it's just an administrative hassle, what economists call transaction costs. You know, there's a provider, there are 100 different health plans. You know, I just don't have the capacity to contract with all the 100 different health plans. So, you know, I'm going to contract with the 5 or 6 big plans, and the others are going to be surprised by my bills. The second reason could be that the health plan has the market power. So basically, the health plan is telling providers, work for us at dirt cheap rates. And the providers are like, no ways. You know, I can't accept this rate. I'll go out of business. So the problem is, in some sense, the market power at the health plan level, which makes their, you know, network inadequate because they're not offering a competitive or a fair price to providers. So that could be a potential reason. The third reason could be that it's the other way around. It's the providers who have the market power, and the health plan is offering a reasonable rate, but the providers have a monopoly in the market, and they know they control, you know, the patients really want to go to them because they control a, say, a large concentration of providers in a certain market. So basically, they're not going to come to the negotiating table. They're not going to accept fair rates. They're going to hold out till the time they get their kind of high monopoly rates. So in some sense, to figure out like which solution works, you, and I guess the fourth option, which could be, is just that providers or physicians like to give surprises. And I have a solution for that, but I'll talk about it later. So I think the key thing is, if it's an administrative hassle, the solution is fairly easy, that, you know, you can reduce the transaction costs. The first time you see a patient from a new health plan, maybe you get UCR or a, you know, a rate, but that triggers that now I need to, you know, go and have a contract with this new health plan. So I think if it's just administrative costs, the solutions are fairly easy. But if it's either market power on the provider side or market power on the health plan side, the solutions are more difficult. And as one of the speakers said, that, you know, it will, this might vary market to market. So maybe in a rural market, you know, a provider has a lot of market power. And, you know, in an urban market, maybe the health plan has a lot of market power. So this might vary depending on how many health plans are competing in that marketplace and how the providers are organized. Are they solo practices or do they have a joint kind of bargaining setup? So if you take the case where providers have market power, what would be the solution? I guess the first solution is, it might depend on whether the service is urgent or not urgent. If the service is urgent, then in some sense, the patient has no opportunity to shop, and you should just, you know, have the government step in and say, this is the price you will pay, and you can decide whatever is the fair price for that service. But if the service is not urgent or is potentially shoppable, then in some sense, you want to keep the consumer in this marketplace because that's how you discipline provider market power. So you want to basically, you know, give consumers enough disclosure and enough opportunity to shop around. So not only say, you know, this is the estimate for this service, but here are a bunch of other providers who might be providing this service at a cheaper price, or here are a bunch of other providers who are in network and therefore your out-of-pocket costs would be lower. But ultimately, then you need to have the consumer make the decision whether they want to go with the higher cost but maybe better quality provider, or whether they want to stick in network with the, you know, lower cost but maybe lower quality provider, and so on. But ultimately, then you have to let the consumers decide what they want to do. If it's the health plan's market power, then you basically want to go with whatever Jeff says, right? That it's basically have new laws which mandate that health plans have to have an adequate network. And so you're kind of now tilting the balance or the bargaining power in favor of the providers. And you're basically telling health plans, if you don't contract with 50% of the providers, then you are liable for any out-of-network bill. Or if you don't contact with a, you know, a fair share of the providers in the market, then you are liable for this. And I agree with Zach and that one way to kind of keep the consumers in this is to make it easier for them. And one way to make it easier is, like, when I shop for a surgeon, I don't think about a surgeon and an anesthesiologist and an assistant surgeon as separate things. I'm just trying to figure out, like, you know, which hospital or which surgeon is going to operate on me. So the prices I see should be for that bundle. It could be for the bundle surgery. Maybe it could be for the entire hospital stay. It depends, because, and the way you define the bundle might change the risks for the hospital or for the surgeon. So if you have a narrower bundle, you just tell the surgeon, when you quote a price, you just can't say, these are my charges. You got to quote the price for the entire surgery. Then there's less risk for the surgeon. Or you could ask the surgeon that, no, it's not just for the surgery, but whatever happens in the hospital while, you know, post-surgery and so on. And then that would be a bigger risk for the surgeon. So what that is, you know, maybe it's open for debate and we can decide. So one last thing that I was trying to figure out, how do we figure out, like, you know, who has, what's the right price, or who, you know, who has more market power? So in economics, there's a concept called opportunity cost, that ideally what we should be paying providers is what they would have earned in their, you know, in their next best job. So if they weren't an anesthesiologist, what would they be, and what would be their earnings there? So, you know, that concept makes sense in theory, you know, in my classroom, but it's very difficult to figure out what that is. You know, I don't know what Jeff would do if he wasn't an anesthesiologist. So I said, okay, let me just, you know, as a layperson, I would want to just know what are providers making? You know, what is their annual salary and how does it compare to something else? So I was sitting here and I Googled it, and it said, looking at the average anesthesiologist salary would make you lightheaded. So I stopped there. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Neeraj. I'd like to give the panelists an opportunity to comment on other panelists.
Yeah. So if I could jump in on the sort of discussion of bundle payments here, which I think is an interesting approach to this problem to think about. I think probably most people in this room are aware that the administration is sort of very enthusiastic about bundled payments as an approach to encouraging sort of more efficient, higher quality healthcare delivery, and that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation has a number of tests underway testing those approaches in Medicare that we're very excited about. We often think about that, though, as sort of changing the structure of care delivery. I think the point that Zach and Neeraj have made, that it also has potential effects on sort of making bills more predictable and understandable for consumers is an important one to think about, given the fact that our cost-sharing systems sort of often sort of follow the underlying contours of our fee-for-service payment system. So I think this is an important point and actually a sort of underappreciated benefit of some of the efforts to rationalize the payment system. The one, and it'll have benefits both in the surprise bills context but more broadly, the one caution I would have is to the extent we're just shifting the sort of bargaining power problem from the insurer down to whoever's holding the bundle, whether that be the facility or someone else. If that's the case, then I'm not sure that we've fully solved this problem. We've solved, maybe helped on the sort of complexity dimension, consumer choice complexity dimension, but we may not have solved the bargaining power dimension.
So I think the way I think about bundle payments is that you're basically now asking the surgeon or the hospital to be the agent of the consumer. So we're basically recognizing that the consumer is going to find it difficult to shop around service by service, but the consumer might find it easier to shop around for a bundle. So whoever is the owner of the bundle is now acting as an agent of the consumer and doing bargaining on behalf of the consumer. And there's evidence of this, for example, in the alternate quality contract in Massachusetts, where they tried incentivizing physicians. And basically what they found was that physicians didn't, when they had an incentive to save healthcare costs, they didn't save it by kind of reducing use of care. Majority of the savings came by figuring out which facility offered the cheapest MRI and sending their patient to that facility. So in some sense, I feel like some other entity who's incentivized to shop around for the patient might be a better shopper for the patient rather than putting the entire onus on the patient.
Yeah, and related, again, we have to get back to this fundamental issue, which is that for certain specialties in medicine, the physician's going to see the same number of patients, whether their price is 1,000, 10,000, or 100,000, right? That they're just not chosen. And as a result, it lets them set a price that's more or less out of thin air. So one approach is the bundle approach. I think the other, in a very, very different direction, sort of a consumer protection approach, where what the Federal Trade Commission would say in some respect or some form is in a sense that insurance companies can't say a hospital's in-network if you're going to go there and get an out-of-network bill. Right? And then what you've basically done is you've put the onus on the insurer, where they can't say something's in-network unless the entire package is in-network. But I think you need to really go in one of these two directions, where we've got to stop treating this indivisible unit as two separate items. Right? The physician in the facility, at least in the case of anesthesiology or assistant surgeons or emergency physicians, those just come together. And whether you go the sort of consumer protection insurance route or the payment route, again, it's really about treating these as one single unit.
So if I can follow up, I mean, sitting here as the one political scientist on a panel surrounded by economists, you know, I really go back in a way to Paul's question to Zach, and you know, it's how do you get from a concept that's very interesting and has a lot of potential to how you would make that happen in reality, and particularly how do you make that happen in sort of the political reality. I mean, if a state decided they wanted to go that approach, you can imagine in a state where, you know, one insurer has, you know, a very, very large percentage of all the of the market, how do you go about, you know, setting up that kind of bundling situation, or where one, you know, the anesthesiology group or the radiology group has got a sort of a statewide presence and they can still say no, and how do you end up sort of giving the tools to either the health plan or the surgeon and sort of that surgery bundle to say, and then the unexpected kinds of things. I mean, when you're in a hospital, you go in for one particular surgery, but then something happens, your heart starts to do something funny, and so suddenly the cardiologist, the convenient cardiologist is called in, that wasn't anticipated, you know, how do you make sure that doesn't lead to the kind of thing? So I think about, you know, again, particularly at a state, if it's a state policy kind of thing, and we're not just redesigning the whole healthcare system in sort of one big swoop, how would it be possible for a state to sort of start that process to occur?
So I think it's a great question. And I think the answer is, how do you eat a whale one bite at a time? And I think you start with some of the units that are more sensible than others. And so I think you start with emergency care, where you just pick one unit that really isn't debatable. And you say, for hospital-based emergency care, this is what it's going to look like. And Jeff's going to come running at me and you know, you're going to tell me this is a bad idea. Yeah, exactly. So he's lurching. He's got the CrossFit ready. You know, but you say, this is where we're going to start. And hopefully it works. Might not get through. But you start one bite at a time. You take this example. It's incredibly egregious. And then if it works, you keep on expanding it out. But I think, particularly with this one, I think admiring the problem just, like, isn't the long-term solution.
Yeah.
I think maybe another solution here is to kind of have health plans more accountable for their narrower networks. So you could, you know, come up with a health plan index saying what fraction of their beneficiaries in the last year faced a surprise bill, or how many of their beneficiaries went out of network. I think that's kind of a summary piece of information, which if I had on every health plan, it would make it easier for me to shop around. Right now, when I see a health plan name, or if I go on the exchange websites, I really don't know, like, what is the size, like, in terms that a consumer can understand. In some sense, I want to know, like, what are the chances I'll face a surprise bill, and maybe that'll give me some pause. I might pay a higher premium for a plan with a, you know, with a broad enough network where surprise billing is lower. So I think in some sense this will again empower consumers to make optimal choices for them. Some consumers might be happy with taking the risk of a surprise bill and having a lower premium, but other consumers might want to minimize that risk and pay a higher premium.
I just want to make an observation that as I've been listening to this panel, particularly the discussion on bundling, and the fact that there's so much focus on the consumer is going to be more important in medical care than that's traditionally been the case. And there are a lot of things that probably have to change in order to facilitate that our medical care system grew up, you know, as a fragmented cottage industry where providers, you know, relationships were developed for the convenience and efficiency of the providers, but of course they were just thinking about their own specialty and niche. And I think people are just reflecting on the panel. I think people are much more serious about the term consumer empowerment and really thinking about how to enable consumers to be more active and more in control of their medical care.
But, you know, I think some of the challenges of that, I mean, I think that as a principle makes a lot of sense. Again, I think the challenge comes in the reality. So, you know, there's two parts to that. There's empowering the consumer who is sitting with a particular insurance policy and is now making provider choices. And I guarantee you we've all tried to go through that exercise of, I'm about to have a medical procedure. Is that particular provider really in the network? And so, you know, part of the consequence is, how do we improve those tools? We had a situation in our own family, you know, very recently, needed a lab test, and it seemed like the lab that was available through where the primary care doctor was located wasn't in the network. So that means now I got to go somewhere else. This family member needs to go somewhere else to go after and seek out that lab test. And even that, I'm saying, well, do we know for sure that that other lab is in the network? So we have those issues, let alone the emergency kind of environment. And then at the point of health plan, I think, you know, there's a question of what are the tools we really need to make those. And I think whoever just said, you know, having that kind of data point on how much out-of-network costs, if we could come up with a good way to measure that and capture that, that would be great to have as a measure. But, of course, it's going to be sitting there as one of many different measures, and we're still asking people to make choices in a very complex insurance environment.
I think it'd be a good time to go to the audience for questions. And is Steve? Right in the corner there.
Hi, I'm Steve Lieberman, and I'm a non-resident fellow at Brookings. Thank you for the panel. I want to go back and ask this broadly, although, Zach, I think specifically your idea about creating bundles. And I think uniform weights and measures improve markets, but they don't solve fundamental issues of economic power. So my question has to do with equilibrium pricing. And I think this is close to what Mark was talking about earlier, about the potential solution of having the hospital be required to have all the people, all the professionals practicing at the hospital be in network. And the question is, how does having package pricing, which I am not opposed to, I think it's a good innovation, how is that fundamentally different in terms of the bargaining power of hospitals versus professionals versus insurers? How does that differ? Because that strikes me as, in the short term, what's the equilibrium pricing is the question.
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. I think the first thing we know is that hospitals have considerably more bargaining leverage than physicians and physician groups. And so I think one safe thing to assume here is if you took my sort of version of this, you might actually see prices go up a little bit, right? In the sense that the hospital is going to be able to negotiate higher prices than the physician will independently. I think what it's going to do is it's going to lower the variance. Right, so by putting this unit in place, you're going to absolutely make the hospitals a little bit more powerful. And there's a whole host of antitrust issues related to hospitals that we could, you know, talk on ad nauseum. But I think what it does do is it gets rid of this particular issue. And again, there are a lot of issues in healthcare, and I think we just have to start one at a time. The more you bring some rationality to the payment system, the more then you can talk about the market power issues, because you've separated having to talk about physicians and facilities independently.
And I think it, you know, the bundle payment does reduce search costs for the patient. So given a number of providers in the market with lower search costs, provider prices have to fall in equilibrium. So the idea is that if I just go to the first provider I see and that's the only provider I go to, that's going to influence provider behavior and they're going to have high prices. But now if you tell me prices of five different bundles for five different providers, and if I shop around, the higher price provider is going to, you know, is going to lose market share, so is going to drop their prices. So in some sense, there's this kind of this consumers by shopping around will influence provider market power. But if there's only one provider, then it doesn't matter, bundle or unbundle, that one provider is going to dictate the price because there's no opportunity to shop.
The woman sitting next to Alwyn that had her hand up.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I'm Claire McAndrew with Families USA. This is a really key issue that we and other consumer advocates have been working on. Taking it back to the conversation about addressing this issue at the federal level, like you mentioned about the need for legislation, I do want to mention that Representative Doggett has introduced an act to end surprise billing last year. No Republicans co-sponsors yet, but a question. In the notice of benefit and payment parameters, the administration did ask for comments on what more they could do beyond, I guess, what I would call a largely symbolic measure to count cost sharing towards the out-of-pocket maximum. I agree it's helpful, but it doesn't actually take on the surprise bill part of it. It just gets at the cost sharing. Do you think there is anything more they could do at the administrative level, or do you think it actually takes, you know, legislative authority under the Affordable Care Act? I didn't know if there was anything they could really do.
So, you know, I think we are sort of absolutely sort of looking for additional things we could do. I don't honestly know how far the administrative authorities ultimately go here, and my suspicion is particularly outside of the individual market, the sort of ability to do things here administratively are more limited. Not to say that, if people have ideas, as said, you know, seeking comment on these questions, I think we would love to hear them, and, you know, things that are feasible certainly would be things we'd be interested in. But I think a sort of comprehensive solution here probably is legislative, ultimately.
You know, and states have found that sometimes because the state has the purview over regulating insurance, that they can do certain things with regulatory authority as long as it's something that they can impose as a requirement on insurance. They don't have the same regulatory authority on the provider side. So, again, there's a limit at the state level of what you can do through regulation, and often to get to these more comprehensive solutions that make sure it's not mostly insurance-focused, they found the need to go to legislative solutions.
Question? Yes, just standing in the back.
Thank you very much. I'm Joel Slackman with the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. And I'd like to take this back to a more basic question. In the report, there's a statement, there's no serious dispute among observers that surprise medical billing happens to a significant extent. And then it goes on to refer to anecdotes and a few studies. But what strikes me is there's really a dearth of evidence about the scope of the problem, the sectors where the problem occurs. So my question to you and Zach in particular, since you referred to research, is do you think that more work needs to be done systematically to understand the extent of out-of-network, surprise out-of-network, the types of services, emergency, non-emergency, sectors, self-funded, group fully insured, since it seems to me that any solution should be tailored to the problem, and the problem, at least as I see from the evidence cited to date, has yet to be explicated very rigorously or comprehensively.
Yeah, so I guess I'll just jump in on that. So I couldn't agree more, right? It's hard to tackle a problem if you don't quite know what the problem looks like. I think it gets at a broader issue, which is the availability of insurance claims data. And you're from, you know, the Blues, so we'll beg on you for data. You know, the more data, we have a lot of data on Medicare. We don't have a lot of data on the privately insured. I'm doing a fair bit with claims data and trying to use it. You know, we do have some research coming out that I hope will put some parameters around it and be able to give us a sense of how often this occurs. I think what you've asked and what you raise is really the need for a national claims database so that we can begin to take the Blues data, for example, and say, how often does this happen to your policyholders? And really, absent more data out there on folks with private insurance coverage who are, you know, they're about 60% of the folks in the U.S., it's just very, very hard to look into it.
But, you know, the challenge is more complicated in the sense that even an insurance claims data set doesn't get you to the full nature of the problem, because if the issue is whether the provider sends that balance bill after the claim is adjudicated, that's not going to be known on the insurance claim, because that's an extra transaction. And, you know, people can report on it, but then we have the challenge of people don't necessarily understand whether the bill they got is a balanced bill or some other kind of bill that's surprising to them, but not what we've defined narrowly here as a surprise bill. We don't know how often, when there is the potential for a balanced bill, that the physicians go out and actually request payment on that balanced bill, reach a settlement amount, opt not to charge, whether somebody else intervenes and covers it. And so it really is a challenge, and I think you point to an important issue. We'd like to know that more, but, you know, we could get part of the way with a more comprehensive insurance claims database, but even that won't get us to really what we're talking about here.
And I think just understanding the causes is probably as important. That does this happen more in markets where providers are consolidated, or does it happen more in markets where insurers are consolidated, mm-hmm. will really help us figure out what the solution should be.
Yeah, so this may be an example of where, because of the problems of the data, policy will move forward based on anecdotes, for better or for worse. We have time for one more question. Yes.
Thanks. I just like you guys to help me understand. Sharif Zafran from Texas. I just want you guys to help me understand one thing. When we talk about economics, you know, it goes back to what the actual market price is. And we're talking around government set rates, this rate, that rate, whatever somebody else decides a rate is, as opposed to looking at actual claims data, which my understanding is Fair Health, which was created for that very reason as a nonprofit organization, has out there. So why is it in a context where you have design networks that are narrow by design, which means people are going to be out of network, or tiered networks where I'm going to be in network with one tier and out of network in another tier, regardless of what kind of bundle you put in a hospital, to benchmark it back to an actual market rate, which if it's paid fairly, eliminates the whole surprise billing problem? So I'm just having a hard time understanding that part of it.
So if I can just jump in for the moment, I think, you know, the point you've raised here is one of the reasons that the administration's proposal was trying to tie to a sort of existing in-network rate at the same hospital in order to try to get to some sort of, and there are sort of pros and cons of various approaches here. But, you know, that said, I think there are a variety of different approaches here, and, you know, each of them have pros and cons from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fundamental issue is that I think the in-network rates have some meaning. The charges really don't. So there's basically a 30% correlation between the charge and negotiated transaction price. And so the question is, when you've got one price that's market determined through bilateral negotiations, and you got this charge that's sort of, you know, pulled out different ways at different organizations, how do you set the price? And I think it ends up being a quite challenging issue.
And I think, you know, again, it depends on who has the market power. So if a health plan has a lot of market power, the in-network rate is going to be inadequate because it's going to be too low that, you know, they're controlling the price. And similarly, if the providers have the market power, the in-network rate might be high. So I think just saying it's a market price and we should pay that is not the correct approach. In some sense, usually paying the market price in a competitive market where both providers and insurers have roughly more or less the same market power, then that price is kind of optimal from a societal perspective.
And, you know, the state solutions have tried to, you know, be reached in the context of the particular political environment that both reflects the market's status in the state and some of the other political forces, and that's led, in a case in New York, to the arbitration as part of the backdrop. So, you know, they can encourage certain things and set certain parameters, but ultimately the protection is that baseball-style arbitration process where each side gets to make its offer and the arbitrator picks one or the other. What they really hope happens is that the fact that one or the other may be picked, and this is exactly the experience in Major League Baseball, is that most cases the two parties will come together on a number. And so if the physicians suggest, you know, their charge rate as their bid into the arbitration, or maybe it's 80% of their charge or 90% of their charge, they're making a strategic decision. If the plan uses its UCR rate or says, okay, but we should come up a little bit because we don't want to, you know, encourage that the arbitrator pick the other side, that's hopefully a process where the two bids will come in closer and either they will reach a deal or the arbitrator will pick one. But that's a way to sort of get around from these standards. Other states have seen that we can take Medicare as a starting point and then use a multiplier to get to a point that sort of works politically in that environment.
I think we've run out of time and need to close the meeting. I'd like to thank the staff of the Brookings Center for Health Policy and the USC Schaefer Center for all the hard work they've done behind the scenes to bring this conference about. And thank you to the audience for coming and for your great questions.